This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Thank you for tuning into our program. A lot of stuff we're going to get to today. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to delve into the MK Ultra program. Do you know what the MK Ultra program is? This is fascinating. It's a fascinating bit of American history. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's not. And look, I realize maybe I'm sort of the boy who cried wolf, because I cover a lot of conspiracy theories, and then for me to profile something and say it's not a conspiracy theory, it's not. So I have on one of the greatest experts on the MK Ultra program, Steven Pinzer. We're going to talk to him in about, 10, 15 minutes or so. And this is a fascinating look. He's got a book called Poisoner in Chief. He's got a fascinating look about what the CIA did in terms of drugging American citizens. And it is really wild. This is confirmed. This is fact. And we're going to delve into it coming up in a few minutes. And a little bit later, Daphne Barak is going to be here. Daphne Barak did a series of interviews with Ghislaine Maxwell. Ghislaine Maxwell, who was involved in the Jeffrey Epstein situation. She is going on trial this week, and Daphne Barak is the journalist, the first journalist to be able to have done these interviews with her from prison. So we're going to delve into that and a whole bunch of other things. But it does look as if the New York governor's race is heating up here in New York. Now, Jamani Williams is getting ready to officially enter the New York governor's race, fresh off his landslide reelection for public advocate. He had already announced his intention to explore a bid for the office. Then he descended on a tour of New York. He met with local candidates in Monroe County. He campaigned for India Walton in Buffalo, who ended up losing. And now he's ready to declare himself a Democratic candidate for the seat, a development that stands to shake up a primary that so far has been dominated by Kathy Hochul and Letitia James. Four people who spoke to Jamani Williams in recent weeks told Politico that he is going to launch his bid officially imminently. Now, what does that mean? I really think so. That means you have Jamani Williams in this race. You have Tish James in this race. You have Kathy Hochul in this race. Kathy Hochul, by the way, just posted some very prodigious fundraising dollars, $10 million in one period. I mean, that's nowhere near the $18 million that Andrew Cuomo had in the bank. But even Andrew Cuomo, I don't know that he ever did $10 million in one fundraising period. So Hochul has been a fundraising machine. You have the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio. So it's going to be interesting. Three candidates from Brooklyn in this race, de Blasio, Williams, and Tish James, Kathy Hochul as well. We'll see who else emerges. Tom Suozzi, Congressman Tom Suozzi, has been talking about running. The thing that I wonder, and I hate to boil down these political races to these identity politics agenda items, but unfortunately in New York these days and in the Democratic primary specifically, identity politics does play a big role. I do wonder if two black candidates remain in the race, does that provide an opportunity for Kathy Hochul, maybe even Bill de Blasio, to slip in there? I don't know, but I can certainly see a scenario in which nobody gets a majority of the vote and somebody ends up winning with a plurality, because there's no ranked choice voting in the governor's race. So we'll see what happens. Look, some of these candidates may end up dropping out if they can't post the necessary fundraising numbers. So it's looking like you're going to have a competitive Democratic primary. there's already a competitive Republican primary. We'll see who stays in it. At this point, you have Lee Zeldin, you have Andrew Giuliani, you have Rob Astorino, and a couple of other candidates that are not as well known have also announced they want to run. But unfortunately, so much of politics, especially in New York State, is defined by who can raise the money necessary. We'll see who it is. If you want to comment on the governor's race, or if you have questions about it, you can call in at 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Now, the interesting thing with Giuliani going forward with this race is, in some ways, it's a rematch of where we were 3 years ago. Because Giuliani Williams had run for lieutenant governor, he had barely lost to Kathy Hochul. And Giuliani, if I remember correctly, beat Hochul here in New York City. So Giuliani's going to have to up his game around the rest of the state, and he's going to have to hold on to those voters in New York City. But, I mean, it's a totally different dynamic with Tish James in the race and with Bill de Blasio in the race. It's a totally different dynamic than where we were back in 2018. We'll see where it goes. 800-848-9222. I'm hoping that a viable independent candidate jumps in the race as well. One of my great hopes is with this new Andrew Yang Forward Party that they'll come up with a viable alternative to the two major candidates as well. As far as the Democrats go, the candidate that I really like is Tom DiNapoli. It doesn't appear that Tom DiNapoli has taken any steps towards running for governor. In fact, it looks like the sort of progressive wing of the party may run somebody against DiNapoli for controller. Maybe State Senator Alessandra Biaggi, former WABC intern, by the way. She was my intern when I produced the Curtis and Kubi show. It was about 16 years ago. Hard to believe. But maybe Senator Biaggi, maybe somebody else. But it would be a shame if the progressive wing chose to take out, of all people, Tom DiNapoli. DiNapoli showed a great deal of courage, in my opinion, by choosing to have the New York State Pension Fund divest from Unilever because of the whole Ben and Jerry's Israel divestment situation. And it would be a shame if that's the issue they choose to make the controller's race about. We'll see what happens. 800-848-WABC if you want to comment. There's two open lines, 1-800-848-9222. Again, we're going to talk about the CIA's MKUltra program coming up in about 10 minutes. And then a little bit later, we will delve into the Ghislaine Maxwell situation. Later on, we will read through your mail. If you have email that you want me to read on the air, just make it witty, make it pithy, make it fun, make it, you know, it doesn't have to be fun. It could be substantive as well. Just make it pithy, short, and to the point. If you want to email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com. We're on Twitter as well, at Frank Morano, and on Facebook at facebook.com/MORANO fan. Let me begin with Mike in New Hyde Park. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Frank. I'm sorry. It's not topical. I'll make it brief. The last 60 seconds of Dominic's program that you participated in, that woman that called in about Trump saying he was unpresidential, I don't understand what she
I think was that was a guy about. That called in.
You got to be kidding me.
Yeah. All right, Mike. Thank you. Let me say hello to Patrice in Brooklyn. Hello, Patrice.
Hi there. And, I want to thank you for taking the call, and I want to thank your screener. You've been very nice to me, and I really, really appreciate that. But I was eating dinner, and I was wondering, you said something about two black candidates on this our next governor's race coming up for the state of New York. And what did you mean by what you said as such?
Well, first of all, why are you eating dinner at 1 a.m., Patrice? I feel like you should be having breakfast or a midnight snack at 1 a.m.
I run a little company, and I was up after work doing too much reading.
Well, good for you.
I'm trying to lose about 5 pounds.
God bless you. I know what that's like. So what I meant was there are two candidates who are black who are running for governor. And that you do see black voters tending to vote for black candidates. So if there was only one candidate in the Democratic primary that was a candidate of color, then I think that person would have a significant edge in terms of getting support from black voters in the Democratic primary. If there's two of them,
right,
then I think they would be probably somewhat divided, and you wouldn't have one candidate dominate the black Democratic constituency in the primary as a monolith. Does that make sense?
Sure. Could Frank, could I ask you a question?
Sure. Yeah.
About that? However, if those two were actually the strongest, with all due respect to the others, and, you know, God bless the others. Trust me, Mike, because I was at Seton Hall
Frank,
Law.
Yeah.
But isn't it, then it wouldn't be the same scenario as you mentioned on the second example, correct?
I'm not sure I follow the second example of what.
I'm sorry. If those two candidates who happen to be black and who are the best to be governor or who are the strongest in terms of their experience, they've been in politics a long time, they, you know, may sound like the strongest to the people and they have a good reputation, they're moral, that have family values, you know, and they seem like no risk. And so if they are this, if they seem like the strongest, then it wouldn't be the same that you mentioned on the first example.
But I don't understand. What's the first example? What's the second example?
The first example you mentioned was if there are two black candidates.
Well, so there are two black candidates. You have Letitia James and Jemani Williams.
Right. But what I'm saying in essence is, if those two are truly the best, or if those two are truly the best, then there would be no risk for them in terms of there being a so-called shoe-in, you know, unquote shoe-in.
Right. Yeah. Again, I don't think there is a shoe-in. I think, putting aside the merits of all the candidates, I have varying views of all the candidates. I think you could see a situation where, let's say Letitia James gets 30% of the vote. Before you get to the point where people are voting, there's a lot of money that would go to a prominent black candidate. Now, if there are two prominent black candidates, that money is divided. And you don't have one candidate being able to sort of run the table as the candidate of the black Democratic New Yorkers. Does that make sense?
And Frank, there are millions of sources for money.
That's true. That's true. And is it possible? Sure. We've never seen it, though, but it is certainly possible. 800-848-WABC. Leo is in Manhattan. Hello, Leo.
Hello, Frank. How are you doing?
Good.
Frank, this is indirectly with the same subject you're talking about. What do you think about idea that in order to get on a ticket in a mayoral or governor primaries, you would have to supply actually doctor's paper that you have at least, let's say, 125, 130 IQ?
I don't think so, Leah. I wouldn't be in favor of that for a few reasons. One, I think that implies that intelligent people are immediately better elected officials, whereas I don't think that's the case. I think that Andrew Cuomo, Chuck Schumer, Elliot Spitzer, all very smart people. However, in the case of two of them, they're very flawed in terms of their character. In the case of all three of them, they're very off base in terms of things that they believe in, although Cuomo doesn't really believe in anything. And I think it doesn't take into account different leadership characteristics that aren't necessarily reflected in terms of IQ. 800-848-9222. Bill is in Poughkeepsie. Hello, Bill.
Yeah, how you doing? Good morning. Hey, I'm done with the black white vote thing. I'm gonna vote for the person that's gonna do the job, and I'm curious to see what this Adams guy does, because there's a lot of cities like Philadelphia, Chicago, New York, Detroit that still got the poverty level, still got the black on black killing, and you know what? It's got to change, bro. You know, that's the problem.
Well, agree, Bill. I don't think anybody should be voting for a candidate that because they're black or they're white. But my point is, they do. There's a reason you don't see any Jewish guys elected in Harlem. There's a reason you don't see any Chinese people elected in Borough Park. There's a reason that you don't see any black candidates elected in the South Shore of Staten Island. Because people who are of a certain ethnic persuasion tend to vote, not always, they tend to vote for a candidate of their ethnicity. There's a lot of theories as to why that's the case. People have written pages, volumes of political papers about it. But you do see black voters tending to vote for black candidates. You see Asian voters tending to vote for Asian candidates. You see Russian voters tending to vote for Russian candidates. You see voters of Italian descent tending to vote for Italian candidates. That's the way it is. OK, now, I don't like that. That's the way it is. That's not how I vote. But that's the way it is. So if we're analyzing elections now, I would prefer if more of the questions were about where all these candidates were on their visions for New York State. I would prefer if their candidate, if it was focused on their past job performance. But I was just mentioning that I think with two minority candidates in the governor's race appealing to the same pool of voters, especially when you have three candidates, not just from New York City, three candidates from the same borough of New York City, I think a lot of the reservoir of support that each of those three candidates, Williams, James, and de Blasio have, might be somewhat cannibalized. We'll see. 800-848-9222. We're going to talk about the MK Ultra program with Stephen Kinzer in just a bit. But let me say hello to Tim in Manhattan. Hello, Tim.
Hey, how you doing, Frank? I just wanted to mention the best thing that could happen to Hulk is Giovanni Williams go in, because he will create a Procaccino Markey effect. You remember that?
Well, I remember Mario Procaccino ran for mayor in 1973, and John Markey.
Both conservatives, Lindsay went right through the middle and back in the city
hall.
Yeah,
no, well, that's what I was saying, is that right. You could have two, within the Democratic primary, two black vote, black candidates splitting the black vote. Let's say Tish James gets 30%. Let's say Giovanni Williams. What?
I know all that.
All right. Okay. So then,
if some of your callers don't know.
All right. Well, I'm not sure if I can.
I want to mention to you, forget what de Blasio. He'll be a non-entity as far as the black vote is concerned, because the only way he gets the black vote is if he's running against whites.
Well, we'll see what happens, Tim. It's certainly going to be interesting. It's certainly going to be interesting. I'm not sure how to make it any more clear than that. I didn't want to make the whole governor's race discussion about race, but sometimes that's what you want to do, and sometimes that's where things lead us. Now, have you seen the news regarding inflation? It's very interesting. At the nearly 75% of Americans are planning to keep holiday gatherings to their household. Some people are saying because of inflation. Now, some in the White House are saying that the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better bill will decrease inflation. But even they're saying, even a lot of economists are saying, in the short term, it may increase inflation. So what does that mean for you? What does that mean for you if you are trying to think about your own long-term financial security? That means you need to think about gold, silver, and precious metals. So if you have, because gold is a hedge against inflation, silver is a hedge against inflation. The worse, the less the dollar is worth, the more precious metals are worth. The more inflation goes up, the more gold goes up, because gold retains its value. The dollar doesn't, especially not these days. It did when it was pinned to gold, no longer. So what does that mean for you? That means if you have an existing retirement account, be it a 401k, a Roth IRA, think about rolling it into a gold or a silver IRA, and think about doing it with legacy precious metals. Gold should be a part of every investor's portfolio. Whether you're ready to make your whole retirement gold or not, it should certainly be a part of every investor's portfolio. And Legacy is the company that you can trust because they give you unbiased information based on your individual situation. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today. Call 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. Or visit LegacyPMInvestments.com. That's LegacyPMInvestments.com.
You're hearing things on 77 WABC.
Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC. The Other Side of Midnight presents...
This is Frank's Conspiracy Hour.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. This is a show where we like to explore some of America's greatest mysteries. I don't think there is a greater mystery than what happened with the CIA and the MK Ultra program. Now, if you like most Americans, maybe you've heard the term MK Ultra and you know that the CIA was maybe up to something nefarious. Well, the MK Ultra program is a whole lot less mysterious, maybe not in terms of motivation, but in terms of what actually happened after you read the book Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. Stephen Kinzer has done a fascinating deep dive into what exactly happened with respect to mind control experiments that, yes, your government was carrying on in the 1950s and the 1960s. Stephen Kinzer is a best-selling author. In addition to writing this book, Poisoner in Chief, he's written many other books before. He's been an award-winning foreign correspondent. He served as the New York Times bureau chief in places like Nicaragua, Germany, and Turkey. He also happens to be a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International Public Affairs at Brown University, and he's a columnist with the Boston Globe. Stephen Kinzer, it is a great thrill to have you on the show. Thanks for joining me.
Can't think of a better place I'd like to be at this time of night.
So before we get into what exactly the CIA did with respect to MK Ultra and experimenting on American citizens, this is true, right? This is not some conspiracy theory like Elvis being alive or Bigfoot, is it?
When you read the book, I have to say that's an obvious question that comes up. I have to tell you, I've written 10 books. This is my 10th book. I've found a lot of things in the course of writing those books that was surprising to me, some things that may have shocked other people. But this is the first time I have been shocked. I still can't wrap my mind around the fact that MKUltra really happened and Sidney Gottlieb really existed. So it's been a strange experience to be living in a room with this guy and with this project MKUltra, which is essentially what you do when you're spending some years writing a book like Poisoner in Chief.
No, that is for sure. Okay. What was the MKUltra program?
After the end of the Second World War, the CIA was created, and it was an essential part of that mindset that told us that the Soviets were doing all kinds of terrible things that prepared them to attack us by surprise at some moment in the future, and that we faced apocalypse at any time. So given this situation, we exaggerated our fears in many ways. One of the ways we exaggerated our fears was that we concluded on the basis of evidence that we misinterpreted that the Soviets, the communists, had not only begun researching techniques of how to control the human mind, but they'd actually succeeded. So the director of the CIA, Alan Dulles, concluded that if you could find a way to control the minds of other human beings, then the prize would be nothing less than global mastery, which was probably true. But he began to think this was real. And he hired a biochemist named Sidney Gottlieb to run this program that became known as MK Ultra. So what Gottlieb decided was that before you could figure out how to implant a new mind into somebody's brain, you first had to figure out how to destroy the mind that was in there. So Gottlieb spent years carrying out the most extreme experiments on human beings that have ever been conducted by any officer or agent of the United States government. These experiments, which involved drugs and sensory deprivation and electroshock and all kinds of bizarre combinations of essentially torture techniques, were aimed at trying to find a way to destroy the human mind and the human body and the human spirit. So Gottlieb, I came to conclude, was really the most powerful unknown American of the 20th century, because he had what amounted to a license to kill granted by the U.S. government and exercised that license in various countries around the world. So on behalf of the CIA, he carried out experiments that destroyed many lives and killed an unknown number of people in this bizarre search that he himself later admitted was a fool's errand, because actually you cannot find a way like it happens in the movies to take over someone's mind.
Wow. Well, so speaking of taking over someone's mind for nefarious purposes, I think a lot of people have probably seen or at least familiar with the Manchurian candidate. And it's interesting to me that the United States government was so fearful of the Soviets being up to something like that in real life. Do we know what other countries, whether it's the Soviet Union, China, or any other American adversary, do we know what they might have been up to prior to America embarking on the MKUltra program? Were they, in fact, pursuing some sort of mind control experiments?
Both of the ideas that we picked up turned out to be wrong. First of all, we focused on the trial of the Roman Catholic prelate of Hungary after the communists took over there. He spoke with a kind of a monotone, and he confessed to crimes that he had obviously not committed. We thought that maybe he was an example of how the Soviets had figured out mind control. It later turned out that he had been coerced by normal means of beating and isolation that have nothing to do with mind control. The other has to do with what you mentioned, the Manchurian candidate. After the end of the Korean War, a number of American servicemen were found to have signed declarations criticizing American life. Some confessed to committing war crimes, specifically being involved in bio warfare, germ warfare, which the U.S. government firmly denied. So the CIA concluded the only way these young Americans could have behaved that way is that while being transported home from their Korean prisons after being released, and the train going across Manchuria, somehow during that trip, some drugs had been fed to them to make them think and talk this way. So the odd thing about that movie, The Manchurian Candidate, however, also comes up in my book. That is the story. What's one aspect of the mind control idea that you'd find some individual, a little bit like in that movie. But that movie actually caused a lot of trouble for the CIA, as I find out in what document that I quote in Poisoner in Chief, because by the time the movie came out in the early 60s, MKUltra was over and the CIA had already concluded that mind control is a myth. But the movie industry hadn't caught up to that. So when finally the big movie about mind control came out, it brought a lot of people, including in government, to ask the CIA, what are you doing about this? And they had to say, we have bad news for you. We've checked it out. And actually, the movie is just a movie.
Talking with Stephen Kinzer, the best-selling author of the book Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. So who was this fellow, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, aside from somebody that was carrying out these experiments? What do we know about him or his background? Where did he come from? Where did the United States government find this guy?
It is such a fascinating story. In the early CIA, all the top figures, almost without exception, were the same type. They all came from the American aristocracy. They belonged to the same yacht clubs and golf clubs. They went to the same colleges and prep schools, and they worked in investment banks and law firms in New York together. It was a real cozy elite. Now they had to find, in the early 1950s, a scientist who was going to carry out experiments that were going to be horrific, bloody, and probably murderous. They didn't look too carefully at people like them. They wanted someone different. And sure enough, they found Sidney Gottlieb, who was so different from everybody else in the early CIA. This guy grew up in the Bronx. His parents were Jewish immigrants from Central Europe, and the father had a garment shop. Gottlieb went to City College. He had a limp. He stuttered. He was so different from all the rest of them. And I came to conclude after going through this whole story that maybe they chose him in part for this reason. They knew he was going to get his hands very dirty. And they thought that maybe it was too gruesome a job to give to a nice person like them. And that later on, they might have to throw this guy under the bus and say, he went wild. It was all his idea. And you wouldn't want to do that to somebody who's part of your group. So Sidney Gottlieb fit that prototype. But there's another interesting aspect about Gottlieb. And that was that he lived totally differently from every other U.S. government employee in Washington in the 1950s. He lived in a cabin in the Virginia woods that had no running water. It was solar powered as much as you could do it then. He wrote poetry. He studied Zen. He got up before dawn to milk his goats. He was like a proto hippie. And I had to deal with this while I was trying to understand this extremely bizarre figure. How does he essentially carry out these horrific tortures? Essentially, he was the America's most gentle-hearted and sweetest torturer in the 1950s. How does he carry all those operations out essentially during the day with no regard for the consequences to human life? And then somewhere on the drive back home to Virginia, he kind of sheds that persona like a snake that leaves one skin behind and becomes this sweet father and community activist who's so beloved by all the people around him. Trying to reconcile these has been a very difficult and not fully successful process for me.
So it seems like Sidney Gottlieb is sort of a real life James Bond villain, maybe our own version of Dr. No.
In some ways, he really is the archetype of the mad scientist. But he had something that the mad scientist in fiction usually don't have, which is the imprimatur of the U.S. government. Now, Gottlieb operated almost entirely without supervision. Nobody knew what he was doing. And there was a reason for this. In the intelligence community, not just in the United States, but elsewhere, ignorance is sometimes an asset. You don't want to know what everybody else is doing because then you're compromised with it. The people at the CIA, the very few who knew what Gottlieb was involved with, understood how awful it was and therefore didn't want to hear anything about it. So that later on, they were able to say, as William Colby, the CIA director in the late 70s, did say to one of Gottlieb's victims, some of our people were out of control in those days. There was a lack of supervision. So this is a wonderful way of absolving not only the CIA, but the entire U.S. government of any responsibility for these atrocities. And that's exactly what they had in mind when they empowered Gottlieb to carry out this project.
So what was the timeline for this, Stephen? When did the United States government and the CIA and Gottlieb start doing these mind control experiments? And how long do we think they continued for?
Gottlieb joined the CIA in 1953, and by within a year of that time, MKUltra was in full operation, full blown. Gottlieb was traveling around the world. He could arrive in Germany or the Philippines and ask the local CIA station or military police to bring him human beings, prisoners or suspected enemy agents or refugees with no friends, and he would experiment them to death. This went on during the 1950s, and it wasn't until the late 50s that Gottlieb's project came under some serious critiquing from inside the agency. Then, like a true Buddhist, instead of resisting in the classic bureaucratic fashion and defending his fiefdom, he said it was, all the criticism was correct. And in fact, it didn't go far enough. The whole MK Ultra thing had been a mistake. There's no such thing as mind control. And by the early 60s, those projects faded away, even though there was no specific end date for MK Ultra. Now, I should add two little points. First of all, various forms of research into this area have continued, in the details of which we're not all familiar with. And secondly, Gottlieb. So what happened to him after that? He went on to a whole other career in the CIA that lasted for years. He was head of what was called the Technical Services Division, or later Technical Services Staff. That's the organization, the giant workshop that creates all of the toys and the gizmos and the weapons, the tools that spies use. You mentioned James Bond. You'll remember in those books and movies. There was Q, right? And so that was Gottlieb for like 7 years at the CIA. And when he retired, that was the top position that, that he had reached. So he had a long and successful career at the CIA. And then he did something very interesting on the way out. At that time, the director of the CIA was Richard Helms. Helms had been something like Gottlieb's rabbi during all the years that he ran MK Ultra. And so Helms was on his way out of the CIA at the same time as Gottlieb, more or less as indirect result of the Watergate scandal. So they got together and decided, remember all that stuff we did in the 50s with MK Ultra? There's seven cases of records about MK Ultra out at Warrenton, Virginia, in the CIA record depot. We got to go out there and we got to destroy it. And sure enough, they sent an order to destroy it, and the archivist resisted, so Gottlieb had to go out personally. And in the archivist's blog, it says that the seven crates of documents were destroyed over my stated objections. So Gottlieb committed a felony by destroying federal property, but at least he'd also destroy the evidence of probably much more heinous crimes.
There's always been a lot of speculation that this MK Ultra program and the CIA's mind control experiments was based in part on experiments that the Nazis may have conducted. Is there any truth to that, that the Nazis sort of paved the way for different mind control experiments that Gottlieb and the CIA then utilized?
This is absolutely true, and I document it in my book. It's one of the most remarkable parts of this story. So I mentioned that Gottlieb wanted to figure out what's the best way to destroy a human being, a human mind, a human body. Like a true scientist, he asked himself, what sort of research already exists on this subject? Who's out there in the scientific world that knows, for example, does it take the same amount of sarin gas to kill a baby as it takes to kill an adult? How about if you rip out one kidney, how long does it take the person to die? And if you inject various poisons into various veins, how quickly does it kill the person? Who knows this stuff? So Gottlieb made the obvious conclusion. Who knows this stuff is doctors who worked in the Nazi concentration camps. And their Japanese counterparts, who in some cases conducted experiments even more awful than what the Nazis conducted. So Gottlieb went out and hired these guys. After the Second World War, through a project called Operation Paperclip, first Nazi spies were brought in to work with the CIA. Secondly, Nazi rocket scientists were brought to work with our rocket program. And then third, Nazi scientists and biochemists were brought to work in projects related to MK Ultra. So I went, when I was researching this book, to the what I think is maybe the CIA's first secret prison. It's a beautiful little chalet in Germany where Sidney Gottlieb conducted some of his heinous experiments. So I went in there. The guy that owns it has now broken it up into several charming condos. And he took me down into the basement where he has storage rooms. He said, in these rooms, the CIA guys and their Nazi counterparts conducted the experiments, which were actually just continuations of the experiments that these Nazi doctors had been conducting only a few years earlier, just down the road at the concentration camps. And the oddest or most bizarre footnote to all of this is Gottlieb himself. So he was Jewish. If his parents had not emigrated from Central Europe in the early 20th century, they might well have been swept up in one of these Nazi roundups. And who knows if young Sidney, sent to a concentration camp, might not have become the victim of one of these horrific so-called experiments in the concentration camp. In the event, he came to America, and then he didn't seem to have any problem working side by side with the doctors who carried out those torturous experiments.
You mentioned Sidney Gottlieb potentially being a victim of the Nazis. In the mid-1970s, the Church Committee, which was a congressional committee set up to investigate different abuses within the intelligence community, specifically those carried out by the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, and even the IRS. Sidney Gottlieb told the Church Committee that he had been victimized. Now, how did the fellow that ran and came up with these mind control experiments claim that he was victimized?
A number of documents were released to the Church Committee that had not directly to do with MKUltra, but that had to do with Gottlieb. So the Church Committee never really laid a hand on MKUltra. They didn't know what it was. It was too controversial. What they were interested in Gottlieb for was something else, which was that he was the person who made all the poisons that were supposed to kill Fidel Castro and Patrice Lumumba and Zhou Enlai. He made the suicide pills for spies and U-2 pilots. That's why I called my book Poisoner in Chief. So that was his job. That's what the Church Committee wanted to ask him about, his role in the assassination plots. Now, in those plots, he was really nothing but a pharmacist. He put together the poisons, but someone else could have done that had he not been there. It wasn't like MKUltra, where Gottlieb was really the mastermind. But the Church Committee didn't know this. So Gottlieb complained that several documents about the assassination plots had been given to the Church Committee, and all the names of the CIA people who were involved with the documents or received them were blacked out, but his name wasn't. It still said Sidney Gottlieb. Mm. So he thought that the old boys at the CIA had decided that we'll give them Gottlieb, in a sense. And I think there might be some truth to that. In the final end, however, Gottlieb had a very clever Washington lawyer, and they arranged for him to be granted immunity for secret testimony, which has still not been released. Nothing came of it. But then Gottlieb was not able to be prosecuted for whatever he had admitted to in private. So although he was very troubled in his later years, he escaped the retribution that would have followed anybody who carried out acts like that on behalf of anyone other than the U.S. government.
I could talk with you about this for hours. I won't, because you've already been so generous with your time. But two final questions I want to ask you about this before we let you go. What has the CIA said about this stuff? Have they issued anything resembling an apology? If not, what have they said publicly?
No. The CIA did. The president of the United States issued an apology to one of the victims of MKUltra, who was a CIA officer. But there has never been a generalized apology. Now, Stansfield Turner, who was the director of the CIA at the time that the existence of MKUltra was revealed in the 1970s, received many requests from people who read about it and thought, that was me. I want to know, what was I one of the victims? Now that explains to me what happened and why my life was ruined after I had that drink in that bar. And he had to write back that we don't know. So there hasn't been a public reckoning for MK Ultra. And the unofficial reckoning, which was also spoken by, as I said, William Colby, is that it was a problem of supervision. That was not anything that the CIA leadership really knew about. That's true. They didn't, but that's because they didn't want to know.
Finally, sir, I think a lot of people may recognize the name Whitey Bulger. He was the head of the Winter Hill Gang, became famous not only for being a gang leader, but for being a government cooperator through a lot of that time. He has claimed that he was an MK Ultra victim. Are there any other famous or infamous victims of the MK Ultra program? Anybody whose names folks might know? You write a bit about Bulger in the book. Anybody else whose names folks may raise an eyebrow at?
No, and the reason is very specific. It's intentional. The whole idea of the experiments on unwitting victims, like prisoners or people who visited prostitutes or people who had some other reasons not to complain, was that you would find people who would not be recognizable to anyone. These were experiments carried out on victims selected specifically for their anonymity, for the fact that nobody would care about them and nobody would believe their stories. We're just lucky that Whitey Bulger put this all together years later, because the prison doctor who was feeding him these massive overdoses of LSD later was revealed 20 years later to have been a part of the MK Ultra project. So we don't know any of the others. And I'll tell you, going through the descriptions of some of those experiments, you really have to wonder, did some of those people ever figure out what had happened to them? I think many must have gone through their whole lives without realizing what Gottlieb and MK Ultra had done to them. It's one of the aspects that makes the story and the writing of that Poisoner in Chief book still so chilling for me. So thanks for giving me a chance to expound on this truly bizarre but 100% true story.
This is incredible. It reads like a spy novel, but it's all backed up with all sorts of documentation. The book is Poisoner in Chief. Its author is Stephen Kinzer. Stephen, you have to come back in the future. There's a lot of other aspects we didn't even get into. I hope we can chat again in the future.
Great idea. Thanks again.
Thank you. If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, you're welcome to give me a call. 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead. That's Pink Floyd, Comfortably Numb. I had no idea you were such a big Pink Floyd fan, Matt. That's two mornings in a row that you're selecting Pink Floyd.
I love Pink Floyd, and actually, to be quite honest with you, this was a Matt Blaze selection.
All right, good. We are double matted today. Matt Blaze is our telephone talent coordinator for the morning. If you want to talk to him, and then that's a first step in talking to me, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 open phone lines. Let me say hello first to Howard in Babylon. Hello, Howard.
Hiya, Frank. How you doing?
Good. Your radio's off, right, Howard?
Yes, I'm in another room.
Okay, good. Because it sounds like it's on, and I'm hearing the show from 20 seconds ago.
Not at all.
All right.
I just want to say that LSD was used frequently in MK Ultra, but the gentleman didn't bring it up.
He didn't bring up that LSD was used?
Correct. It was used heavily as a form of attempted mind control. It was given to people without their knowledge.
Well, yeah, I mean, I mentioned that LSD was used.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I mean,
that's fine. I took it dozens of times, but I knew what I was doing. I wouldn't. You never gave it to somebody without their knowledge.
Well, yes, of course. It's never something that you want to do. I think. Thank you, Howard. The fact that you have taken LSD multiple times is the least surprising moment of this show so far. Larry in Brooklyn, hello.
Hi, Frank. You know, I have no doubt that these experiments took place, but I just have a couple of questions. First of all, if all the records were destroyed by the Sidney Gottlieb, how did he get enough documentation to put together a detailed book? That's the first question I have. And the second question I have is the supposed Nazi scientists that were recruited by the CIA, if a lot of them were, I would suspect were war criminals, and how would they trust the U.S. government? Because they could have been hung. I mean, Dr. Mengele was on the run at the time. Why didn't they get him, you know? These are a couple of questions I have.
Yeah, well, they're both good questions. You know, I can't speak to the state of mind of the Nazi situation. Most of the sources from the MK Ultra program, some of it is based on testimony and reports from the Church Committee from 1975. Other parts are people that spoke verbally with both the author and other people. You know, for instance, Ken Kesey, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, he's mentioned in the book. He got his LSD in an experiment sponsored by the CIA. So did Robert Hunter, the lyricist for the Grateful Dead. And Allen Ginsberg, the poet who everybody knows, he got his first LSD from Sidney Gottlieb. Of course, a lot of these people didn't know it by name, but that's a fair question. I have no idea how to answer the Nazi question, Larry. 800-848-9222. That's 800-848-WABC. Now, Whitey Bulger, he wrote about his experiences afterwards on the CIA hiring Nazi doctors and Japanese torturers. That is, to me, one of the most interesting aspects of this book. These Nazi doctors had conducted all sorts of experimentation, and the CIA hired them and because they knew that the Nazis had been involved in this kind of thing. And the Nazis provided information about poison gases like sarin, which is still being used today. So it's a fascinating book, and I definitely recommend you check it. I'm going to invite Stephen Pinzer back. I've been trying to get him for a few months now. I had the book, actually, for a couple of years, and I had been researching this, and then his name came up as one of the go-to experts on this. I said, wait a minute, I think I have that book. And I started looking through the book, and it provided so many interesting details. So I'm going to try and get him back maybe next week or the following week, and I will bring up why the Nazis chose to cooperate with the CIA. I think in part because they were being paid pretty handsomely. And number two, the CIA kind of operated, as the intelligence community seems like it does so often today, as sort of a government within a government, not necessarily one to hand over war criminals or people like that. So we'll see. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Next hour, we're going to go through your email. So far, I only have about three or four good emails. So if you have anything that you want to add some grist to our ever-grinding mill, you can email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com. We'll get into the Ghislaine Maxwell situation in a little bit. And I will, you know what we'll explore? You know what appears to be waning, of all things? Home ownership. We'll look into that in just a bit. This is The Other Side of Midnight. In the words of the great Bob Barker, make sure you help control the pet population. Get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
everyone. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. My wife and I have been living in our house for 13 months. We bought this house last October of 2020. And I have to tell you, no, it's great. It's great. It's great to have a little bit more space than we did in our prior apartment. And it's great to be able to have a backyard, to be able to entertain, do a fire pit, smoke a cigar and so forth. I have to be honest, had my wife not insisted that we get a house and move, I probably wouldn't have. I loved apartment living, both when my wife and I lived together, even before we were married, and then before we moved in together, I lived in an apartment by myself. And I love everything about apartment living. I love that when it snows, you don't have to worry about shoveling the sidewalk. I love that something breaks, you can call somebody. I enjoy apartment living. I enjoy not having to spend money every time anything is broken. And if there's bugs, you don't have to hire an exterminator. I loved it. Now, I've recognized for years, and I think most people will tell you, that in the long run, home ownership is a much better investment than simply spending your money on an apartment. A big part of that reason is, at least under the existing tax code, you get such a tax advantage by having a home because you can deduct the mortgage interest. You can't deduct the rent that you pay for your apartment. There was a U.S. Senate candidate and a congressional candidate, Shel Farley, when she ran against Kirsten Gillibrand a few years ago, she made the point that you should be able to deduct your apartment rent from your taxes. And I found that very appealing. But now something interesting is happening. COVID, it's no secret, inflamed the real estate market. We've chronicled how many New Yorkers moved to the Hamptons and elsewhere, how many people moved to Florida. COVID and the whole pandemic and the lockdown, it pushed Americans towards the suburbs because, after all, if people don't have to go into the city to go to work, what do they need to live in a city for? They could live in the suburbs. It changed the relationship with where we live, work, and play. It also accelerated interest in built-to-rent housing. But even before the pandemic, built-to-rent housing was expanding at a breakneck pace. The number of built-to-rent homes, which are single-family homes constructed expressly for the purpose of renting, increased, this is a huge number, 30% from 2019 to 2020. 1 year, it increased 30%. Today, they make up about 6% of all new homes being built in the United States. And that number is poised to double in the next 10 years. This is the fastest growing sector of the American housing market. And it is increasingly master planned and built on tracts. On the fringes of America's second-tier cities, entire villages, sometimes owned by large-scale investors, sometimes not, but entire villages are popping up, offering renters who either can't or don't want to spring for a down payment another path to the American dream. The New York Times real estate section had a very interesting story about this trend. I'm going to link to it on my Facebook page. If you want to read the whole thing, you can on Facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's Facebook.com/MoranoFan. And so now I find this whole trend pretty interesting. Many built-to-rent housing projects just look like any other suburban community, usually with smaller backyards, sometimes with the houses squeezed a little bit closer together. Houses often have luxury finishes like granite or quartz countertops, stainless steel appliances. And for tenants, the traditional hassles of home ownership, which is what I like to avoid, the traditional hassles of home ownership are avoided. So common areas are
maintained by gardeners and maintenance staff, a service for which renters often pay an additional monthly fee of about $100. If a toilet breaks or the roof leaks, management takes care of it. So these are the numbers. 108.5 million. That is the number of Americans who rent. 30%. That's the increase in built-to-rent single homes from 2019 to 2020. 35%. The share of U.S. rentals that are single-family home. $77,000. That is the median household income for renters in new single-family rentals in 2018. The median for homeowners, $114,000. 36%. The share in of families in the U.S. in which the head of the household is a renter. And this is the last one I'll mention, 37.8%. The share of Americans under the age of 35 who own homes, 37.8%. So the quality of these built-to-rent homes, in many cases, holds up to those of traditional homes. And for customers hesitant to put down long-term roots, a lot of people think they're a better bet. Norman Miller, who's a professor of real estate finance at the University of San Diego, said, quote, if you don't think you're going to be someplace for 3 years or more, the transaction costs are just too high to buy. The only downside is you're going to lose out on the investment aspects of home ownership. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. With more of the country, particularly younger people, moving more towards renting rather than home ownership, curious what you think that portends for the future of the real estate market and for the country as a whole. 1-800-848-WABC, particularly if you've made the decision to rent rather than buy or buy rather than rent. Love to hear why you made that decision. 800-848-9222. They chronicle in this article of the Times, Brian and Amanda Voorhees. They moved with their two children to a community in Jacksonville, Florida. It's actually 40 minutes from Jacksonville, Florida. They left New Jersey after selling their 3,600 square foot home at the top of the market, and they weren't ready to jump into a new investment. We really wanted to have the flexibility to enjoy life versus having to worry about repairing the roof or cutting the grass rather than heading to the beach. We didn't want to have to worry about all the potential pitfalls of home ownership. I got to tell you, if I were single or I were married to a different woman, that quote would be from me. That quote would be from me. 100%. And they rent their new home, the Voorhees. They got a four-bedroom townhouse for $2,600 a month. And this is becoming more and more common, particularly among younger families. So the Voorhees family and other families that are chronicled in this article, they represent a growing contingent of Americans who make relatively high salaries, but they're opting not to buy. In 2019, a Wall Street Journal analysis of Census Bureau data reported that the number of households with six-figure incomes who were renting had reached 19%. That was up from 12% in 2006. So in 2006, if you made a decent salary, it was pretty rare for you to rent. By 2019, it was becoming increasingly common. But that sector in the rental market is eclipsed by another, meaning adults under 35 who, according to the Census Bureau, have the nation's lowest rate of home ownership. I mentioned it, 37.8%. Now, some of that is not due to choice. Some of that is due to necessity. Rampant credit card and student loan debt, coupled with an inflated housing market and stagnant earning potential, now means that Americans in Generation X, who are between the age of 40 and 55, have four times the assets of America's youngest adults. Now, that's alarming. You talk about a wealth gap from one generation to the next. Think of that. From Generation X to Millennial and Gen Z, they have four times the amount of wealth. So a lot of these millennials may want to buy a house, but they can't afford it. So you have two trends going on in the country right now driving housing, which is you have a lot of people that could afford to rent or they could afford to buy, and they're choosing to rent. You have a lot of other people, they can't afford it. What do you think this means for the future of the housing market? What do you think this means for the future of the economy? What do you think this means for the future of the country? Now, when you picture America, right, you picture the golden age of America, what do you think of? I mean, you think of the 1950s, white picket fences in suburbia. You have your own house. Guy's out there. He's watering his lawn. All the neighborhood people get together on Saturdays for barbecues. The kids are on the neighbor's lawn playing wiffle ball. Everybody's laughing. Everyone's talking about the weather. They're all preparing their cherry pies for the church bake sale. Connie or Becky is coming home in a red sweater telling you all about the latest 4-H meeting. That's what you picture, right? When you picture idyllic America, Norman Rockwell and so forth. Nowhere, I'm betting, in your version of the American dream, the stereotypical American dream, do you picture renting. But renting is only growing. Over 107 million people are renting. And this trend of houses that are built not for sale but for rent is going to double in the next 10 years. The national homeownership rate is plummeting. Now, into this melee, the emergence of long-term remote work has offered younger Americans an exit route out of the nation's most expensive urban areas. You try and buy a house in New York City, good luck. Good luck. You're better off spending that money buying lottery tickets first so you can afford a house in New York City. So, but as these younger folks begin to marry and think about having children, the built-to-rent revolution is reviving the possibility of a suburban lifestyle that many of them thought they just couldn't afford. So where are you on this? Home ownership versus renting, and wherever you are on it, I'd love to know what you think this means for the future of the country. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. John calling from Manalapan, an area that is filled with Staten Islanders. Hello, John.
Hey, how are you, Frank? It's great talking to you again.
Likewise.
So I'm 31 years old, and I'm getting married January 16th. I own a business in New Jersey. I rent an apartment right now. There's no way I'm going to buy a house in New Jersey, anywhere in New Jersey or New York. Property taxes are through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like on top of a mortgage, it'd be at least $1,000 a month for property tax. I don't want to waste the money on that.
Well, I hear you, John. I hear you. Let me ask you this, though. If they brought back the SALT deduction and you could deduct more than $10,000 in property taxes, would that change your view at all?
That's a good question. I don't think so. To be honest, it's so much easier to just rent
it is.
And not
See,
worry about it.
That's where I'm coming from, John. And that's why, you know, this was one battle my wife won. But that's where I'm coming from. That, to me, is the appeal of renting over home ownership. It's so nice not to have to worry about everything. So nice if something starts leaking, you don't immediately have to panic and worry about how this leak in your basement or a busted water heater is going to change your whole life.
Yeah, my future plan is I would rather live in an apartment for 10 years, save up money, and move somewhere cheaper like Florida or something and buy a house there.
Well, but still, but that's interesting that you indicate you're still planning to buy ultimately, John.
Oh, yes, but just not in this area, you know?
I hear you. All right. Well, thank you for sharing that, John. You know, it's funny. I have always wanted to buy a home in Atlantic City, even before I was interested in buying a home of my own here in New York. I wanted to buy a home in Atlantic City that I could use both as a rental property and as a place to stay. Maybe rent it out a couple of months a year and on the weekends, and then use it as a place to stay when I go down there from time to time. But, you know, you look at the price of the of houses in Atlantic City, they're pretty cheap. But the price of the real estate taxes, the property taxes are through the roof. We looked at this, and the amount of property taxes for a one-bedroom condo in Atlantic City is as much or more than we pay for a house in New York City. I mean, it goes to show you how out of whack some of these pricing schemes are. But tell me, renting or buying? Renting versus home ownership, why did you make the decision that you did? And what do you think this trend portends for the future of the country? 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. 5 open lines if you want to jump on board. Let me say hello to Jack in Tinton Falls. Hello, Jack.
Hey, Frank, how are you? Yeah, I spoke to you last month, Jack from Tinton Falls.
Yeah, I remember. So you guys reelected your 95-year-old mayor.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. You got a good memory. Yeah, he's reelected. He's all settled. He's staying put. He's a good guy. They had a special on him on the news, too, based on how old he is. I think he's the oldest mayor
in America. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, so the topic of home ownership versus renting, you know, it's from an investment standpoint, you know, a lot of people like to talk about real estate as an investment. It is just very expensive. I mean, if you have $1 million and you want to buy shares of Apple, it doesn't cost you anything to make that investment. Your million goes all towards those shares. If you have $1 million and you want to buy a home, the closing costs are astronomical.
Oh, you got to hire a lawyer. You got to pay the mortgage broker. You got to pay the real estate agent. It's you got to pay everybody.
It's nonstop. Everybody's got their hand in there, and the carrying costs compared to owning a stock are extremely high too. Because, you know, like your previous caller mentioned, the taxes obviously, but you know, just ongoing maintenance and utility bills and so on and so forth. It's just a very expensive endeavor. But for people that, you know, own, you know, too much stock and have a lot of money, it can be a good way to diversify. Personally, you know, I like owning versus renting, and I've done both because, you know, you don't have to look over your shoulder when you own the house when making decisions about home improvements or maybe something unique you want to do.
Well, that's a good point. That is a good point. I remember when my wife and I moved into our last apartment, we had to pay a pet deposit fee for each of our three cats. I mean, who wants to, you know, if you want to get a pet, you want to get the pet and deal with the implications. There is an element of control and security that is very appealing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's, you know, for very wealthy people, it's a good way to diversify if you don't want to just only own stocks. But for me personally, you know, and I own stocks, you know, diversifying into real estate, it's too expensive of an endeavor from an investment standpoint. I mean, I've owned several homes too, and, you know, timing wise, sometimes you can get lucky and, you know, from an investment standpoint, you make money. But most of the time, it's just, you know, you're hoping that when you're on the way out of this home, you know, the market's doing well and, you know, you can sell it for more than you paid for it. But, you know, it's stocks historically are up more than they're down. With real estate, I find it to be very expensive and less opportunity.
Well, the big difference is, and I've looked at the comparative investments of real estate versus stocks, the big difference is you can't live in a stock, whereas you can live in a real estate investment, and you do save money on the cost of rent, because you got to live somewhere, and if you're investing in a house, then that's money that you're then saving on rental costs.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you're going to be longer in term, then it, you know, for me, in my opinion, it makes sense to own. If you really are unsure about what your long term strategy is, you know, and you're comfortable renting, then you should most likely, you know, rent. But you know, the thing about renting, especially in Jersey and New York, rents have gone up just like home prices have gone up. And in addition to that, a lot of times it's difficult to find a rental. And Frank, let me tell you something. Many times it could be easier from a background check and a credit standpoint to get a mortgage than it can to get into a good rental because of the you know, the homeowners or the rental owners, I should say, the landlords, they put up very high barriers to entry as far as, you know, credit score and background checks, and you better be squeaky clean because, you know, they've got the pick of the litter.
Yeah, that is a great point, Jack. Thank you. 800-848-WABC. We'll continue taking your calls on this in just a moment. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
77 WABC, All-American.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. This is a song called Corcovado. If you're ever curious about the bumper music we play, including those that make you think you're in a dentist's office, you can go to Facebook and join our Facebook group. Just search Morano Radio Fans and Haters, and we'll post the bumper music that we play each and every morning after the show. Just search Morano Radio Fans and Haters, M-O-R-A-N-O, Radio Fans and Haters. Talking about this trend towards renting, younger people especially seem geared towards renting rather than buying homes. Question is, what did you pick? Question is also, what do you think that portends for the future of the country? 800-848-9222. If you want to read the article in the Times real estate section on this front, just go to my Facebook page, facebook.com/MoranoFan, and you can read the article for yourself. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Neil on Staten Island. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Frank. I'm surprised that younger people want to rent. You don't build up any equity. I mean, it may be a little easier than having to take care of a home, but you have nothing at the end. At least when you have a home, you have some value to it that's yours. You've given it away as a rental. You give it to somebody else. You're not really gaining anything. Also, for you, to buy a house in Atlantic City, I mean, that would have to be the biggest mistake you'd ever make. It would be like having an alcoholic rent a room in the bar.
That is very true, and that is a fact my wife has reminded me about repeatedly. Neil, that's very funny. That is it's very true. But you're right. The equity aspect of home ownership is the other thing, other than the tax advantages, which has historically always been the reason why owning rather than renting tends to be a better investment in the long run. Good point there, Neil. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Dana in Brooklyn. Hello, Dana.
Hello.
Hi, Dana.
Hi, it's Baena, Frankie. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Baena. Okay.
Yeah. I'll make it brief. I was accepted to NYU Medical School, but I also went to the real estate certification to sell real estate or be a broker in real estate. And I just wanted to mention, Frankie, that in regards to a renter, a person who's renting his or her apartment, he or she should have an accountant, but also there can be a tax deduction for the rental only of the part that is being used for the business. The federal taxes can be deducted, but the person really needs to check with a CPA for either the federal and also the state.
All right, that's certainly good advice. Absolutely. 800-848-WABC. Al is in Brooklyn. Hello, Al.
Hi. I have an answer for you that make happy you and your wife.
Okay.
You take a real estate management firm to manage the entire property.
Okay.
So your hands are not tied down to anything, cleaning, garbage, everything from A to Z. You have insurance in all major parts of the house. You just make one call. They'd have to take care of it. And then the inflation with Biden, with the economy, the only way you're going to keep your money, like, stable, you're invested in real estate, and that's going to go up, or the money's going to become worthless or whatever. At least you can have property. And then once it's stabilized, you'll be able to sell and you'll have your money back.
All right. I'm not sure I follow, Al. So if we already have a house, so you're saying we sell it to a real estate?
No. You have a house. Now you go, you hire a real estate management firm. Takes out the garbage, washes the halls, does all the main stuff.
Yeah, I don't know about that, Al. I don't know about that. Phil is here in New York City. Hello, Phil.
Hello.
What's on your mind, Phil?
I just wanted to tell you my experiences buying property in this lovely state.
Okay, tell me.
I found it to be incredibly unprofitable.
Phil, can you do me a favor and turn your radio off, please?
Yes, certainly. I have both commercial and residential, mainly commercial investment properties around the state, as does my family. And we have done nothing but lose money for decades.
Mm.
The prices in the Hamptons are highly depressed right now. And both
I'm surprised to hear that. All I've been reading is about the prices in the Hamptons going up.
Try to sell your house.
I see.
Try to sell a nice house. A substantial home. Now my tenants in my commercial building have been given forbearance, so I get a bill from the management company instead of a check, and we don't know when the tenants are going to be we're being nice to them, so they're commercial tenants, of course. I don't do personal. And we're waiting for the government to let us start charging rent again. And so, on the whole, I had this issue in 2006 when I first got married and was advised, actually, to rent a home. And when I look at the properties that I could have purchased maybe 15 years ago, I would have made no money whatsoever.
Wow. You would have made no money if you bought or if you rented?
If I bought.
That was right before the housing crisis, the mortgage crisis.
Exactly, but there's no intrinsic stability to purchasing. And I would say the only benefit of purchasing would be having your own personal space and not letting a landlord push you around.
Yeah, well, I there's a lot to be said for that, Phil. Thank you for the call. And one of the things that I like to do is I like to put up lawn signs of different candidates for office that I'm supporting. And that is nice. That is something you generally can't do in an apartment. But I'm not sure of these built to rent facilities. I'm not sure what the rules are there regarding political lawn signs, but I would guess there's a prohibition in a lot of these communities, but I don't know. That's just my guess. It doesn't say that in the article. And there is something nice. There is something to be said for having control over your own property, which is not necessarily measured in a dollars and cents measuring of this. 800-848-WABC. Pete is on Staten Island. Hello, Pete.
Hey, Frank. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. It was Pete, thank you again. Let me thank you publicly for your contribution to the Tunnel to Towers Foundation the other day. Very generous of you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Things I wanted to talk to you about, which we said about the rental. I rent on Staten Island. I'm 66 years old. I never thought of buying because I don't like to be a place that if I feel uncomfortable years later. Like I lived on, I'm going to say, Durant Avenue years ago, or maybe about 3 years ago. And there was a big problem with the drug problem with the kids and stuff. I actually was walking in the house one day carrying a pizza, and some guys tried to mug me, you know. And now I moved to an area which is not really a pleasant area, but for me, it's a good fit because I'm pretty gutsy guy at 66. I handle myself quite well, and I live off of Jersey Street. Now, I find it to be happy up here because I got a landlord that is a gem, you know, and that's the whole thing. I mean, to me, you know, when I would pay real estate tax and everything else, it's for about what I'm paying to live here, so I'm comfortable. Now, the other thing I want to ask you, I'm hearing about a possible exhibition fight between Curtis the Rock Sliva and Frankie Russo. Do you think that might become possible?
I think it's pretty unlikely. You know, with Curtis's arm is still in a sling. And,
no, I mean, he needs at least 6 months to heal up. I'm talking down the road, and hopefully when this Cobra thing ends that, you know, people could all get together at maybe Snug Harbor or, you know, in New Jersey. I think it would be a great fundraiser for the police and firemen and, you know, an exhibition, not to be brutal in each other. I'd be even willing to be the referee. I have experience in boxing.
Well,
I sparred with Gabe Perillo and Joey Palmieri.
Yeah, so I wouldn't count on it, Pete. You know, at the Lucky Snake Arcade at the Showboat, there's a boxing ring in the arcade there, a great boxing ring. And I actually suggested to Sid Rosenberg recently that he do a rematch with Bernard McGurk because they boxed before. And I said, you do a rematch, Bernie McGurk versus Sid Rosenberg, War at the Shore, right? And McGurk Rosenberg 2, War at the Shore, and it'd be great. We could all go down to Atlantic City and watch them. I don't think a Curtis versus Frankie Russo match makes any sense, just because, quite frankly, and it's not to be dismissive of Frankie Russo, but nobody really knows who Frankie Russo is. I mean, he's got a very, very niche audience. Curtis is a national figure. I mean, if you wanted to talk Curtis Sliwa versus Eric Adams, Curtis Sliwa versus versus Sid Rosenberg, that's another thing. But Curtis
right, but
versus
that could be a good undercard. I think it would be two matches with Rosenberg and Bernie and that. I'm talking about, you know.
The city needs something. Yeah, I'm all for an exhibition boxing match. I don't think Russo versus Sliwa is going to happen, and I don't think enough people would. I don't think enough people know who Frankie Russo is, to be quite honest. And again, nothing against him, but I just don't. He's literally not in Curtis's league. Frank is in Brooklyn. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Frank. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Thanks for keeping me up again.
Oh, well, my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
It is mine. Concerning the younger people buying homes, I live in Brooklyn. I mean, I lived in New York City my whole life. But example here, an average home of six, you know, one bedroom, rather, let's call it a one bedroom, $600,000 to $700,000. You have to come up with 20% of that. So that's a buck and a half. Mm-hmm.
Well, right. That is one of the things that's in this article that they're saying is a lot of people either don't want to part with that money or they're not able to come up with it.
And if you're young, you know, it's going to take you a while to accumulate that kind of thing. Unless you have parents who are fortunate enough to lay down a down payment with you or not. And the second thing is that, you know, a lot of young people, 30s around there, they don't want to bother with the mowing the lawn and that kind of stuff. You know, the in and out, banks, home, and the renting is good, especially if you can score a decent rent someplace that's not exactly prime Manhattan or prime Brooklyn. But even at that, that's a hefty number, too. But who the hell has the
you know, the $200,000 or more, then you've got the legal fees to go into that to buy a home. That's the big, big reason. It's not like 20 years ago we get something for $300,000.
Yeah, it's such a good point, Frank, and really well said. And Tucker Carlson, not in his most recent book, but the book before that, he talks about why socialism is so attractive to young people. And he cites almost exactly what you just cited, Frank. He said, look, here's this whole generation of young people. They worked hard in school. They did everything they were supposed to do. They took out loans to go to a great school. They got great grades in high school, got great grades in college. And then they got great jobs. And then, lo and behold, the joke's on you. The piece of the American dream that has to deal with home ownership in the city that you grew up in, especially, not going to happen. Now, here comes this group of people, and this is Tucker's phrasing, not mine. Here comes this group of people that said, hey, just don't worry about that stuff. Student loan debt, everything else, well, you don't have to pay it. So that is one of the reasons, the fact that young people can't afford to buy houses today because they're so saddled with debt. That's one of the reasons that socialism is so attractive to young people today. And Tucker has written a great deal about this. And I think he's more right than he is wrong on this front. Let me say hello to Charlie in Hell's Kitchen. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, Frank. So I called to talk about this topic about home ownership versus rental. I think a lot of the reason why the tax favorability for home ownership is because the real estate industry put pressure on Congress to make the tax laws favorable for home ownership, and because renters are seen as...
Well, you're right about that. You're absolutely right about that.
And renters are seen as more unstable to the functioning and the life of a community rather than like the view of suburban home ownership that you had talked about before. But I want to transition this into a larger philosophical discussion. What I've noticed that's happening in society, particularly by government leaders, is there's a movement to equalize things out. There's a movement like to straighten out or get rid of inequalities, which either happen in nature or happen in life. And I was wondering if you would notice the same thing.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the point, Charlie. So have I noticed that there's a movement to do away with inequality?
With inequality, sure. And I'll mention the two most common forms you'll see in the political leaders are trying to address are racial inequality and income inequality that our political leaders seem obsessed with trying to address. And the reason why I was thinking is that there are just natural inequalities in life. And the obvious example I was thinking of, which occurred to me, was if you think of the House of Representatives, or Congress is passing all these laws. We just signed, President Biden just signed it all, $1 trillion infrastructure bill today. And if you think of the House of Representatives, the two most famous people in the House of Representatives today are both women. And one would be the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and the other one would be Congresswoman AOC from there, who many people believe really and actually runs the joint. Now, if you think of these two people, one of these two women has a very pretty face, and the other woman doesn't. And so,
it's a little unfair to compare a woman that's 30 with a woman that's in her mid to late 80s, isn't it, Charlie?
Yes, it is. But the point that I'm trying, that's absolutely correct. But the point that I'm trying to make, and I'm making this tongue in cheek, obviously, is are we going to, in the next Build Back Better plan, set aside a pot of government funding, set aside a pot of government money so that women who have, let's say, faces that look like Nancy Pelosi can get cosmetic surgery to improve their lot in life and more or less equalize the outcomes?
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so. Trust me, if they start subsidizing plastic surgery, then maybe even I'll be for the Build Back Better plan. I need, I'm certainly not a candidate to be on the cover of GQ anytime soon. But I think on that note, that non sequitur, that's as good as a time as any to move on to other areas. But if you want to email me with your thoughts on the subject, you can do so, frank.morano at wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano at wabcradio.com. I will tell you, though, speaking of home ownership, yesterday, Sunday technically, Sunday, my wife tells me they are coming to drop off a new sofa. And I said, they're coming on Monday to drop off a new sofa. I said, well, why do we need a new sofa? And it's a complicated series of events. It's sort of like the lady who swallowed a fly. So I'm not going to chronicle for you the entire cyclical nature of why there needs to be a new sofa. Suffice it to say, we need a new sofa. Because my wife gave to her sister the sofa that was in my office. It's fine. She can have it. And the plan was to initially put a sofa that's in that office that could be used for sleeping. Put a pull-out sofa in there so that we're going to turn the guest bedroom into our baby's bedroom. And so if people want to stay over or if they have to stay over, they can sleep on the sofa bed in my office. That was the plan. I'm not exactly sure when that plan got torpedoed, but you know, my wife makes all these decisions. I sit there and nod. Occasionally I'm asked to pay a bill, but I just sit there and nod. I trust she has good judgment. But except when I start paying attention is when it turns into work for me. So Sunday, I had hoped that my brothers could come over and help me move this sofa from the living room to my office to make room for the new sofa that was going to be delivered Monday morning. Clear, right? Okay. They're not available. Weren't available. They couldn't do it. Couldn't get there early enough. Fine. Okay. So that means I have to figure out a way to move this sofa into my office by 8:30 Monday morning. So, but I leave here around 6:15, 6:30 in the morning, and I start a group text message where I text message all the people that live in my neighborhood. Text message about 7 or 8 people, you know, guys, mostly guys that are awake and usually able to help with a favor. And I said, hey, if anybody's available to come move this sofa, could really use your help. Shouldn't take very long. It's not heavy. And I'll pay you the a competitive wage. Now, obviously, I'm expecting them all to do it for free. But I really only needed one person. I mean, if there were 2 people, that's great. But I really only needed one person. To his credit, the first person that gets back to me is the minority whip of the city council, Joe Borelli, who pretty soon hopefully will be the minority leader. So Joe says, all right, well, I'm going to have my son with me, but I can be there by 8:40 if that's okay. Great, great. Because the timeline for the new sofa coming is between 8:30 a.m. and 11 a.m. Great. So if we can move this at 8:40, that's wonderful. Then I get another text message from Joe's predecessor in the city council, my friend Vinny Ignizio, close friend who was best man at my wedding. Great guy. Hey, Vinny texts me privately. He says, hey, do you need 2 people for this or are you okay with 1? I said, no, I need the 2. He said, great, I'll come over. So Vinny gets there first, and I'm thinking, this is great. The 2 of us are going to have this couch moved even before Joe Borelli gets here. So Vinny and I had already removed all the cushions upon arriving. So I got home around 7:30. I slept for about 45 minutes, woke up when Vinny got to my house around 20 after 8, we move all the cushions off the sofa. I had done that when I came home. So the cushions are all moved. So Vinny and I lift the sofa up, and this sofa has been with us. This is the 3rd residence that I've been in that has had this sofa. I love this sofa. It was in my apartment when I was on my own, my so-called bachelor pad. It was in my apartment that I had with my wife, and now it's been in our house for the last year or so. But now it's time, servicing our living room has come to an end and it needs to be moved. So Vinny and I lift it up, not very heavy. I'm walking backwards. We're walking. And we finally get to the door of my office. And then all of a sudden Okay, well, it's not going that way. Let's pivot like the Friends episode. Okay, no, it's not pivoting. Let's twist it like they do in the Family Guy episode, the Star Wars episode. Okay, that's not working. Okay, let's turn it vertically so that we can get it in that way. And it turns out the sofa is too tall to get through the door. We cannot get the sofa through the door of the office. All right, so now we're panicking here because I have to get this done, one, before this new sofa comes, and before Rachel, who's 9 months pregnant, becomes increasingly ornery and unhappy with me. So I said, all right, let me take this door off the office. Maybe that'll give us another inch or two. So I popped the door off the office. Now, this is exactly what I want to be doing after having worked for the last 15 hours, okay? It's not sleep, but remove doors and carry couches is exactly what I want to be doing, dealing with this staff here. So then at this point, now the couch is in the hallway leading to my office. So, and we're having no luck getting this couch in, even once the door removes. Now Joe Borelli has arrived. Joe is offering his 2 cents. He's trying to contribute. And now we're tripping. Okay, what if you stand in the bathroom, Frank stands in the office, Vinny stands in the hallway, we all twist this way. No dice. Not working. Now we have no idea what we're going to do here because we have a couch that is going to take this couch's place in just a minute. Okay, so then we decide, kind of a battlefield decision with Rachel's cooperation. Now, of course, Joe's son starts crying at this point, and Rachel turns to him. He says, oh, what happened? Did Melky scratch you? Yes, of course. The cat scratched him. The poor kid had not been warned to stay away from the gray cat that's mean and scratches children and adults alike. You talk about equity, as Charlie was talking about there. Melchizedek is an equal opportunity scratcher. He'll scratch anybody, old, young, male, female, white, black, gay, straight, transgender. He doesn't care. He'll scratch everybody. So the poor kid's crying because he's been scratched. My wife's trying to console the kid and shout instructions to us. So we decide to move this sofa into the bar room, which means playing Tetris with the furniture that's in the bar room because there's a giant bar in there. 3 or 4 bar stools. There's a wine fridge. There's all this liquor. There's all sorts of other stuff. I got all sorts of other stuff. So we move the sofa in there, but we have to move the bar. Now, it turns out this bar must be about 2,000 pounds. So the three of us, strapping as we might be, we can't move this bar. So we end up finding a way to slide this bar. And I'm sure it's going to look terrible, but my priority is getting this done so that I can go back to sleep. And these guys are on a schedule. They both have to start their workday. So we are able to move the sofa in, and we're able to move the bar to a place where Rachel thinks it looks okay. The kid stops crying, and I'm able to go back to sleep, which is a big victory. And then Rachel tells me, hey, honey, I have a Zoom conference from 10 to 11. If the couch people arrive while I'm still on the Zoom conference, you have to deal with them, which means now I will have to have gotten up a second time, right? I got up once to move the sofa. I'm now having to get up a second time to receive the sofa. So they come around 11 and I get up. I start making my way down there, and Rachel had finished her Zoom and she dealt with them. But as it stands now, we have a new couch in the living room. We now have a couch in the bar room. And there's still no couch in my office. Now, what's the plan for a couch in my office? I have no idea. Neither does anybody else. There's no seating in there. So if you come to my home for a ping pong match and then you want to have a meeting after the ping pong game, can't do it in my office. Nowhere to sit. It's just a lot of empty space out there. Maybe I'll put another bookshelf in there with my surplus of bookshelves. So that's where we are. 800-848-WABC. We'll go through your mail next. If you want to email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com.
WABC. WABC, where the action is.
called This Is the Tetris Theme, which Joe Vinny and I were hearing in our brains today as we tried to rejigger the bar room to accommodate a sofa that never should have been there. But there we have it. All right. It is now time for... First email comes from Daniel. You can email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. Daniel writes, how did you get the original sofa in the room when you moved in the house? Why couldn't you just take the sofa out the same way you brought it in? No! The sofa was never in that room. The sofa was in the living room, and I was trying to move it to my office. A professional mover or even somebody like Tommy Barlotta would never have made that mistake. Now, by the way, Tommy Barlotta, the father of the Tommy Barlotta theorem, on what age group is appropriate to date. That's what he's famous for. Now, email here from Greg. Greg writes about our transgender segment yesterday. What is for you to understand? This is about the child and what his parents understand, not for you to need to understand or your audience. Lay off this topic. You sound stupid here. Best, Greg. Okay. Steven writing, hi, Frank. Not only do I hear from strangers, which doesn't bother me so much, but one of my sons with a divergent political philosophy dissed me publicly for not fact-checking the Aunt Jemima story before sharing it. Said he fact-checked and it was done by a right-winger. A loving son, he only was trying to make me a better social media player, he told me by phone a day or so later. I usually only post lighthearted stuff, but some of my friends post stuff like, if you watch 2.5 Sons, unfriend me immediately. Why the need for that? I am with you. Laura commenting on my wondering what kind of hat Vinny the Chin Gigante's wearing in the photo I posted on Facebook. She writes, Frank, I didn't want my comment to get lost, so I just want to say that it's a poor boy cap, not a 1930s newsy cap, which is a bit more tailored, and a newsy is somewhat of a sports cap, only flared a bit on the side like a golf cap, which is a backwards surgeon cap. Leo called earlier. He wanted to know why we didn't speak longer about his suggestion that politicians take an IQ test. Sorry, Leo, the clock is our enemy. To be continued.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Good morrow, everyone. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Matt, would you read that Steve Bannon story for me again, please, that you just read during the top of the hour news?
Yes. Steve Bannon says he's planning to go on the offense after surrendering today on a contempt of Congress charge.
Because it sounded like you said something other than contempt.
What did I say?
I don't know. It sounded like contempt.
Did I say? I must have said like contempt accidentally.
All right. Well, good. Okay. Just wanted to make sure I didn't misunderstand.
No, you're good.
Okay. You know, it's funny. When I finally got to sleep yesterday, I got to sleep around 7:30 after taking my first attempted sleeping situation. The phone rings around 7:35, 7:40. I forgot to put it on Do Not Disturb. Actually, I didn't forget. I left it on so I could see if people were contacting me about moving the sofa. So who do I see is calling? It's Roger Stone. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, I know Roger's been trying to get a hold of me. Should I talk to Roger Stone or should I try and get my 45 minutes of sleep? So what would you do? I got my sleep. I didn't talk to Roger. I called him back today. He wanted to talk about the Bannon stuff. And then I'm not sure if I'm supposed to say this, but he's having lunch with President Trump today, actually. And so he wanted to go over stuff with his meeting for President Trump. So I gave him a couple of things that I'd like to bring up with President Trump. So we'll see. Hopefully we'll get President Trump on this show sooner rather than later. We'll see if Roger can put in a good word. Now, meantime, Lin-Manuel Miranda. We all know Lin-Manuel Miranda. He did Hamilton. He did In the Heights. By the way, I didn't realize that that Andrew Cuomo play, which my wife said she found the Andrew Cuomo character a little bit similar to the King George III character in Hamilton. But the Cuomo play, Turtle on a Fence Post, that's closing, this engagement of it is closing on Sunday. So if you haven't gotten a chance to see it and you want to see it, go see it by Sunday. It is really well done. TurtleMusical.com, TurtleMusical.com. So Lin-Manuel Miranda, he did Hamilton, he did In the Heights. He was on one season of Curb Your Enthusiasm. He's done a bunch of other things. He did this lengthy interview with The New Yorker, who did a very nice profile on him. And he talked about the backlash against his own projects. Now, Lin-Manuel Miranda is as PC as can be. I mean, he took a period of American history that was dominated by white men and made it dominated by people of color. He recast American history with black and Latino people. Good for him. So he talked about how, we talked about it at the time, Miranda received some hate for his musical film In the Heights, where he was slammed for lacking Afro-Latinx representation. So he explained to The New Yorker that he understands that critics will have opinions about his movies regardless of his success. Quote, once something has success, you're not the underdog trying to make it happen anymore. You have to graduate past the mindset of, like, it's a miracle I got something on the stage, because now that is expected of me. And people go, yeah, but what about this? What about this? And that's fair. I do with art. I do that with art I find lacking. It's not cancellation. That's having opinions. So I try to take it in that spirit. So Miranda, they're sort of portraying it as if he's fed up with cancel culture. But, I mean, if you read that quote, it doesn't really sound like he's fed up with cancel culture. It sounds like he understands cancel culture, even if he's the one being canceled. So Miranda added that he won't let the haters influence his creative process, despite his willingness to hear criticism head on. The challenge I find myself in is, how do I stay hungry? How do I still feel like I have something to say and not worry about what's not in the frame? I'm just trying to build the frame in the first place. Certainly, I have learned lessons from the reception of my work, good, bad, and indifferent. You try to take all of it, and whatever sticks to your gut is what you bring with you to your next project. The tick, 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 boom filmmaker. Oh, excuse me. Tick, tick, boom. That's a new film that he's doing. If you get yourself into a place of fear of what are people going to say about what I write, you're blanked. It's over. And that's a place I have to really push past now in a different way. At the end of the day, you can't control how the world receives something. He went on to say, all you can control is what your intentions are. And if it closes in a night, those 6 years don't feel like wasted time because you learned from it and you put everything you had into it. So he apologized earlier this year following the In the Heights controversy, saying he was truly sorry on Twitter. But I think Lin-Manuel Miranda is right on the second part of what he's saying. I don't think he's right on the first part. So we do have a cancel culture, and I think everybody should be sounding off against the cancel culture, even if it's a conservative cancel culture. You know, I saw that the Wisconsin Republican Party, excuse me, the Wyoming Republican Party just voted to do away, to cancel off, what's her name, Liz Cheney. And they voted, I think, 31-29 so that she's no longer considered a Republican in the state of Wyoming. Now, I'm not a Republican, and I'm certainly not a Cheney fan. But that, to me, is conservative cancel culture. You can't deviate from Republicanism or conservatism on anything, even if it's an infrastructure bill that's good for your constituents, without being canceled. And it seems like you have this whole PC cancellation, people that want to cancel Lin-Manuel Miranda and In the Heights for not enough Afro-Latinx characters or not enough Afro-Latinx representation. You have people that want to cancel somebody for everything. But so while I don't love that Lin-Manuel Miranda sort of accepts the cancel culture, in spite of what all the headlines about this story seem to suggest, I do like what he says. I do like what he says where you can't allow it to influence what you do. You can't do these shows, and I feel this way about this radio show. You can't get yourself into a place of fear. What are people going to say about what I write? Now, I think that's important for every artist to keep in mind, and it's certainly something that I try and keep in mind. Sometimes I'll be tempted to talk about something or do something on the air, and maybe I'll stop myself and say, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe I'll offend people. Maybe that's bad for my image. Now, I certainly don't say anything that's offensive just for the sake of being offensive, as some, you know, shock jocks might. But I do try, if I think there's something to be gained from talking about something, either for informational value or for any purpose, I do try to talk about it irrespective of what the consequences are. So 800-848-9222, if you want to talk about your reaction to Lin-Manuel Miranda's commentary to The New Yorker, the headlines all say that he's fed up with cancel culture, but it doesn't sound that way. If you read the actual quotes, he says he understands. He says it's not cancellation, it's having opinions. So you want to weigh in, you can. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. And coming up in just about 10 minutes, we're going to talk with Daphne Barak. She wrote this, she did this series of interviews with Ghislaine Maxwell from prison. And she's talked all about it. This is one of her first radio interviews. I think it might be her first radio interview. And I want to ask her how she got Ghislaine Maxwell to agree to one of these interviews. And two, what effect this is going to have on Ghislaine Maxwell's trial, because jury selection started here in New York yesterday. She's been locked up for 15 months as part of this Epstein case. And it's going to be very interesting to see where things go from here. I'm certainly eager to see where they go from here. By the way, if you didn't get your email read in the mail segment last hour, you can email me at frank.morano@wabcradio.com, or you can send me a letter. I do like plain old regular snail mail. Our P.O. Box is P.O. Box 1777, New York, New York, 10163. That's P.O. Box 1777, New York, New York, 10163. Just send it to my attention. Attention, Frank Morano. I'm sharing a mailbox with Larry Kudlow. And so the two of us share a drawer where we both get mail. I don't think Larry has taken his mail in weeks, because it's the same parcels that look like they're always in there. So if you're sending mail to Larry, you might have to wait a little while for a reply. I at least look at everything. P.O. Box 1777, New York, New York. Send it to my attention, Frank Morano. So I am told that that Molly, our associate producer, that this is her last day with us before her vacation. And evidently she's going to Myrtle Beach for a wedding. And so, Molly, now, what did you say? You said your boyfriend, first of all, whose wedding is this? It's not yours. It's not yours, is it?
No, not my wedding.
Well, that's cause enough for congratulations. Just kidding.
I disagree. I'm in the other boat. No, it's his best friend from high school.
Your boyfriend's best
my
friend.
My boyfriend's best friend from high school, yes. And actually, interestingly enough, I met this couple we had been together for 2 years when I first met this couple. They weren't even dating yet. And now we're 5 years into our relationship, my boyfriend and I, and this couple is getting married. And I met them, and he had introduced this woman as his friend. And clearly they're not friends.
Well, so were they dating at the time?
No, not even. They weren't even dating
when you
yet.
Say he is your boyfriend or no. It's the groom?
The groom. Introduced the woman that he's marrying as his friend when we were visiting them 3 years ago.
But you already knew them?
No. That was my first time meeting them. I don't know these people at all.
I see.
So, this is just a vacation for me.
But you said you first met them, they weren't even a couple.
They weren't even a couple yet.
But then how were you introduced to her as his friend?
They were seeing each other.
Oh, they were a couple.
Well, you see, these young people, they date for a long time before they're dating. You know?
I see. Okay. Now, so Kellen is in the wedding party?
Yes.
And so he's a groomsman?
He is a groomsman.
Not a best man.
Not the best man.
Okay, well, it's not a bad place to be. It's a lot less pressure. And you're not in the wedding party.
I am not in the wedding.
And you seemed pretty excited about that before the show.
I'm very excited about that. Because there's a beach, there's a pool. He's got to go to the bachelor party. And I don't even know if I'll be invited to the rehearsal dinner. I'm not expecting that. That stuff's expensive, you know? I don't want you to spend your money. They're buying a house together.
No, but if they're having a rehearsal dinner, you have to invite the wedding party with their significant
others. With
their
date? Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't expecting that. I've never been to a wedding. Or this is only my second wedding.
So have you been to a wedding before where your date is in the wedding party and you're not?
No. The only other wedding that I've been to is not had a wedding party even, so.
I see. So that's why I was interested in your analysis that this was a positive thing, because I have been to several weddings where I'm in the wedding party and my date is not. And I always feel bad for my date because chances are if I'm in the wedding party and they're not, they may not know a lot of people there. And if we're going together, then they have to get there super early when I have to get there.
Well,
and they're not necessarily, it's a lot of just sitting there for them.
Let me confront you real quick, Frank, and ask you, why do you think that you're the interesting part of the wedding?
No, I don't. But chances are if there were the other people that my date knew, then they could talk to
them. That's the truth. I do know nobody. So I might come back with a totally different, like,
I see. All right.
Like, I mean, obviously, like, I want to spend time with my boyfriend. I'm here all the time, so we don't even get to spend that much time with each other. So it would be nice to be with him, but I don't really want to hang out with people that I don't know, especially, I don't know, COVID is still a thing. My brother just got over COVID, so that's on my brain. Still going, but...
But... Since you don't know a lot of other people at the wedding and he's going to be involved in all these groomsmen activities, aren't you going to be doing exactly that, socializing with all these people that you don't know?
At the wedding itself, yeah. I'm pretty good at that, though.
Right.
I'm very good at meeting people.
Yeah,
and I bought some books.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So,
Well, have fun. We'll miss you.
Yeah.
I am surprised, though, that I always thought that was the toughest spot in a wedding, to be the date of someone that's in the wedding when you're not in the wedding. That's happened to me at least three times, actually, that I can remember. And it's always a tough spot for the date that I've brought. I'd be curious what your experience is on that front. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Or if you have any tips, either for Molly or somebody that's in Molly's shoes, or the boyfriend who's in the wedding and, you know, wants to make sure, I'm sure, that his girlfriend is still entertained and having a good time. Because you have so much to worry about when you're a groomsman. I imagine the same is true for a bridesmaid. Imagine it's true for a bridesmaid also. When you have, I'm trying to think if I've ever been the date of a bridesmaid to a wedding. I don't think so. I don't think I have, unless I was also in the wedding. But it's very tough to be the plus one of someone that's in the wedding because you don't know a lot of people, and yet your partner, the only person you do know, is involved in all these activities. So 800-848-9222 if you want to add your two cents on that. 800-848-WABC. Meantime, I do want to talk to you about Life Change Tea. You may have heard me talking about Life Change Tea from GetTheTea.com. I know my colleague James Golden has been doing these commercials for Life Change Tea. And some of you might be asking, well, what is it? Simple as can be, it is a daily cleanse. It's a gentle daily cleanse that tastes great and works to get things moving. It's no secret that stress wreaks all sorts of havoc on your digestive tract. And if that leaves you feeling stopped up and bloated, that's never a good thing. Life Change Tea is all natural, non-GMO. One package will last you an entire month. Life Change Tea is only available by logging on to the website, GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. And if you order using the promo code Frank, you will get some free shipping. So you go to GetTheTea.com, you use the promo code Frank, you'll get to enjoy free shipping. It's time to feel relief, and while you're there, you could check out all their other great products. They have a lot of other great products. I've been taking the pine bark extract. It's great. Gives you a ton of energy if you have to try to go to sleep three times before you can finally go to sleep. Pine bark extract is great. My wife was taking the Coral C. The Coral C is great. Colostrum is also a great digestive aid. There's all sorts of great stuff. You can check out all the terrific products which are designed for your optimum health. So don't miss out at Life Change Tea at GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. It is the tea that makes you go. All right. You want to comment on the wedding situation? You can. You want to comment on Lin-Manuel Miranda's views on cancel culture? You can. We have eight open lines. Now's the time if you've ever dreamed of being on this radio show and you've always said, oh, I can't get through. I can't get through. Well, now if you call now, you'll be able to get through. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. In the meantime, I do want to remind you, Daphne Barak is coming up in just about 10 minutes. She had this terrific, terrific piece in the Daily Mail on Sunday, doing this exclusive interview with Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, it just so happened, I had breakfast with Daphne on Friday, and she told me the story was going to break, and all of a sudden, I had no idea this interview was going to be as groundbreaking as it was. But sure enough, disgraced socialite Ghislaine Maxwell goes into some detail in terms of what life is like for her in jail. And spoiler alert, she's not exactly getting the VIP treatment. At least that's what she claims. All right, we'll talk with Daphne Barak next. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.
You go, go, go with 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
It's funny how money changes situations. Miscommunication leads to complications. My emancipation don't fit your equation. I was on the humble, you on every station. Someone play young Lauren like she done. But remember not to game the one under the sun. Everything you did has already been.
This is Lauryn Hill. Matt, what song is this? What is this?
One's called Lost Ones.
Lost Ones. I see. All right. Well, hey, different strokes for different folks. How did this wind up in our approved music library?
We just recently got a new shipment of all new music, and some of them are absolutely amazing. We got Sugar Hill Gang, Rapper's Delight.
Oh, well, that's
others.
Good. That's
yeah.
Good.
And I see we got a couple, obviously, for the Sinatra show. We got a couple new Sinatra songs.
Yeah, Piscopo told me about that. So yeah, can you send me an updated list of our music library? Is that possible? Do we have an updated list?
I can request a PDF.
That would be great.
I'm going to send it to you.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Great. All right. 800-848-WABC. We're going to talk with one of my favorites, Daphne Barak, in just a moment. I do want to tell you, though, this is somewhat breaking news. Friday morning, I have agreed, it's not that I've agreed, more like I have begged for another opportunity to take on Bernard McGuirk in the Beat Bernie contest. And I am very much looking forward to doing just that. So if you're not familiar, Beat Bernie is a contest where listeners can take on the smartest man in New York City, Bernard McGuirk. And a couple of months ago, they did this celebrity Beat Bernie where they allowed employees of the company to compete against Bernard McGuirk. Now, I'm sure this is like how it is for you when you play Stump Frank or Stump the Audience or the $1,000 Minute, and you always know the answers when you're at home. I play Beat Bernie at home and listen, and I win a lot. I'm as good or better than Bernie, I'd say 40% of the time. But sure enough, I went on that Beat Bernie edition when I competed against him and was embarrassed. I was getting questions wrong that I should definitely have known. And there is a lot of pressure when you're in that kind of game show environment. So Friday morning, there will be a rematch, Bernard McGuirk versus versus Frank Morano. Sid Rosenberg will be the questioner. So if you have any tips of material I should be studying, if you've been studying the questions and detect any trends, or if you have any tips in terms of how I cannot psych myself out. Now, I think this one's going to be a little different in that I'm going to be in studio with Bernie. Well, I'm going to be in studio with Sid, and Bernie's going to be in studio separately, obviously. And we'll each have our opportunity to answer these five questions. Now, that's good and it's bad. It's good in that I'm very comfortable in a radio studio, but it's bad in that that denies me the opportunity to cheat. I'm not going to be able to look up things quickly and answer the questions, which I would do if I were at home. So that's Friday morning at 9:40. You're going to be sure to want to watch that. Meantime, the story that everybody is talking about, not just in New York, but literally around the world, has to do with this world exclusive that was published Sunday in the Daily Mail. Ghislaine Maxwell tells all from inside her U.S. prison cell. Lo and behold, the journalist that did this story is a friend of mine and a former guest on this show, documentarian, author, and journalist, Daphne Barak. Daphne, it was great to see you Friday morning. Thank you and Bill for buying breakfast, number one. And number two, congratulations on all the story, all the attention the story is getting.
I know, Frank. You know, Bill and I did tip you off over Bloody Mary's early Friday, right?
Yes, I will tell folks, so my reputation is secure, your Bloody Marys were Virgin Marys. Mine, of course, were not.
Well, you know, nobody's perfect, right? But,
all right, so
we are not anti-alcohol, just
you
know, right?
Duly noted. Daphne, this is an incredible, incredible story. First of all, for people that may not know about Ghislaine Maxwell and her history and only know her as a player in this Jeffrey Epstein story and know about her through her arrest and prosecution, who is Ghislaine Maxwell? And more importantly, I guess, who was she prior to this Jeffrey Epstein case and her arrest?
Ghislaine is a youngest daughter of nine of a media tycoon, Robert Maxwell. Since we are talking about New York, Robert Maxwell actually saved the Daily New York Daily News of New York, which was the biggest paper at the time, but of course had money problems. He bought it in 1991, otherwise it would collapse. And he was the biggest hero of New York. He was invited everywhere. He owned the Daily Mirror. He owned the European, everything. And a few months later, he suddenly was found dead off his yacht, which was called Ghislaine, on his youngest daughter. And at the beginning, it was a huge tragedy, which, of course, it's a tragedy when everybody dies. But a few days later, it was revealed that he wasn't a billionaire like people thought. He owed lots of money. And in order to keep floating, he stole the pensions of his employees, which was horrific. And the UK law was changed afterward that you cannot really, as of Maxwell, as of 1991, you cannot touch anymore the 401k of your employees. And I met Ghislaine Frank when I did the only interview with her, the only television interview with her ever. I didn't know it would be that big, of course, at the time, because at the time, Rupert Murdoch, I was the interviewer of Fox 5, and I was syndicated worldwide, and Rupert Murdoch asked me to do it, to do the first interview with her mother, Betty Maxwell, the widow of Robert Maxwell, for the first anniversary of his death, which was November, 29 years ago, November 1992. We flew Betty from UK to New York. I asked, you'd love that. I asked Donald Trump, who owns the Plaza in New York, to give us a discount because, as you know, that's why Rupert is so wealthy. He always likes to save money. And after we flew her, the budget was almost zero. Donald was extremely gracious. We put her in a beautiful suite. And when we met her, her youngest daughter, Ghislaine, joined us because she was already in New York. She wanted to help her mother, and she filmed with us as well. That's why the only interview with Ghislaine is at the Plaza, which was owned by Trump, and the next door Central Park.
So your relationship with Ghislaine Maxwell and her family goes back nearly three decades. So it makes sense that if she was going to do one interview from prison, that it would be with you. So you guys clearly go back a ways. Now, I'm going to go through some of the things that that she revealed to you in this this interview, which is published by the Daily Mail. I'm going to link to it if people haven't read this on my Facebook page at facebook.com/MoranoFan. But before we go into what she said, which was pretty interesting, I'm curious if you can give us an idea of what the time frame was for your conversation or conversations with her. Did these conversations occur a week ago, 2 weeks ago, a month ago, 6 months ago? Can you give us an idea of the time frame?
We cannot give too many details because, you know, she has enough restriction as it is, as you saw in the quotes from Ghislaine, the first time, her own words from jail. By the way, my relationship don't go three decades. Yes, it was 29 years ago. I saw Ghislaine then, and then I saw her a few years later. At the time when I saw her, you'll love that, Frank, she said she didn't have any money. She lost everything, which was true. And she said that she was living in a very small studio, toilet size, around 67th Street, Upper East, in New York. She said, in a toilet-sized apartment, which was given me by a friend called Jeffrey. Da-da-da. Who would have known? And then she came. She called me 2-3 years later and came to see me for another interview just to help her brother, the brothers Kevin and Ian Maxwell, which are being interviewed to our CBS Paramount Plus series. Which is ITV in UK, but here at CBS Paramount Plus, were facing a big trial. They were accused of all the charges that their father did, and they were acquitted. So basically, I, after these two interviews, I have not kept any, I've not kept in touch. It was 3 months ago when Susan Zirinsky, which is the first woman ever to be the president of CBS News and a very good friend of Bill and I, called me and asked me to sort of lead the interviews of this new series of CBS Paramount Plus, which called Ghislaine. And I wanted to think about it because it's so toxic, made a few phone calls. And when I realized how badly she's treated and I talked to her family, I said to Susan, okay, I'm in. So that's
Okay, well, so let's get into what she said here. And if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Daphne Barak. She's an international interviewer and executive producer. She has interviewed everybody from Michael Jackson to Ghislaine Maxwell and everybody in between. And I had the opportunity to have lunch with or have breakfast with her and Erbil Gunasti, who's been a guest on this show before. He's directed a lot of the great interviews, a lot of the great documentaries that Daphne's interviews have been featured in. So, Daphne, in this discussion that you quote her in, she describes some pretty gruesome treatment. She's being held here in Manhattan at the Metropolitan Detention Center. She spent the last 16 months in solitary confinement. Now, why is she in solitary? Is that meant to be punitive or protective?
Well, I guess it's meant to be protective, but it is very punitive. You just imagine, Frank, you and I and Bill here next to me are so social. Just imagine to be isolated 24/7 for more than 500 days. What this family feel and what Ghislaine feel is that basically she's being punished because Jeffrey Epstein, by the way, she is not dated Jeffrey Epstein after 2003 or four. She has been living with a billionaire called Ted Wide in San Diego, and then she got married to this guy who's much younger, Scott, in Massachusetts. So Jeffrey Epstein is really, really her past. But they feel that because Jeffrey Epstein died, and there are many theories, Frank, as they said, he killed himself. But many people don't believe he killed himself in the most secure prison in America. But as they feel that only when he died, they needed to go after somebody, and they went after her. And I want you, Frank, and your audience to notice that she was not charged for anything as long as Jeffrey was alive. Her attorneys were in touch with the authorities. She was not charged. When Jeffrey died, her brother, Kevin, was very concerned, and he asked a friend of him, which is the head of a security company, Matt Hallier, to take over. And basically, they told her, leave the country. We want you to leave the country immediately. Ghislaine refused. She could have avoided all the situation. She could have taken the first flight out, private jet or commercial flight, and leave the country. She refused. And then, as you remember, Frank, there was a very, very long period of 11 months that everybody was looking for Ghislaine. She was the most hunted woman in the world. But she was escaping not the authorities. She was escaping the media. And frankly, because many people thought that Jeffrey Epstein was killed, she knows a lot. And she was also running away from a potential killer.
Yeah.
So that's the idea. Bill wants me to remind your audience that, as the Daily Mail said, more updates and more information would come daily on our NFT, which the link is www.og2d.com. Again, www.og2d.com.
OG2D.com, talking with Daphne Barak about the Ghislaine Maxwell situation. If you haven't followed this case, it's pretty interesting. She is being accused of procuring and abusing young girls in concert with and on behalf of billionaire financier Jeffrey Epstein. She has denied these charges vehemently, and jury selection has begun for her trial here in New York today. So, Daphne, let's talk about what she says in this article. How about in terms of food? What kind of diet has she been enjoying in the Metropolitan Detention Center for the last 16 months?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not keto and not Atkins. it's horrific. And to commend her after this treatment, she still didn't lose her sense of humor. And don't forget one thing, Frank. Ghislaine Maxwell has not been charged yet. She's presumed innocent unless...
Well, she hasn't been convicted yet. Right. She is exactly. entitled to a presumption of innocence. Absolutely.
Like all of us. And this is part of the American Constitution.
Until a week ago.
Yeah, she right. wasn't even charged until a couple of weeks ago. Right. They didn't know what the charges, who are the charges. Yeah. So that bothers me. Now, people told me, you know, there are hundreds of inmates who have not been charged in America. Many of them are poor or African-American. They cannot afford a proper representation, legal representation. And Ghislaine says, well, that's maybe good that it's happening to me. It's horrible, but maybe because of me, we are highlighting the situation that people in America, we are supposed to be the biggest democracy in the world, just sit in jail forever before they're even being charged of anything and being treated as if they were convicted, which is horrible. So her diet is, as she said, rice and beans. There's no nutrition. She said mayonnaise, a bit for fat. And she got an apple with maggots, and she got a piece of bread, which was so wet, full of water, that the water was just going out. Now, she said that she cannot take showers because she used to take a shower daily, but the guards are just there watching her so closely. And so it's so creepy that she cannot do that. She used to go to the toilet. There was an open sewer, so there was a what she said, quote unquote, a friendly rat there. And she tried to complain and nothing happened. And
now, this rat, just to for sake of clarity, this rat is not a cooperating witness. This is an actual rodent.
Yeah.
Got
exactly.
It.
Exactly. And until the rat actually bites one of the guards, there was nothing being done. And then she said something which, for me, the most horrific thing is that she was laughing one day and the guard didn't like it. And he said, who do you think you are? Why are you laughing? I'll teach you a lesson. I'll make sure that you will not be able to see your lawyer for 1 month. Now, thank God it didn't happen, but things about her, she's trying to prepare for a trial and she's being threatened not to see her lawyers, and she's not allowed to call anybody or complain, right? And every few hours she's being searched in the most intimate parts of her body, and sometimes it's completely hurting. And what is she being searched for? She's in isolation. She's in a confinement, in a solitary confinement. So she doesn't see anybody anywhere.
Well, I mean, so, I guess the people on the other side of that argument will say we have to make sure that, that the Jeffrey Epstein situation with a mysterious suicide, every precaution is taken to make sure that that doesn't happen. But that doesn't excuse this kind of abusive treatment, what you're describing and what she describes. One of the things that we've seen before in criminal trials is the prosecution and the Department of Justice try to taint the jury pool before any evidence is heard in the trial and try to portray the accused as some sort of a monster so that they're ready to convict even before hearing the evidence. Does Ms. Maxwell believe that that's what's happening in her case?
Absolutely. And so does her family. For the CBS Paramount Plus series, we interviewed her brothers, Kevin and Ian, her sister, Isabel. The head of the security, for example, was so convinced that she's not running away that he was willing to put part of a package bail deal, £1 million, which is like $1.3 million, only of his own money. And by the way, she was denied bail four times. And what are we talking about? I mean, hey, George Floyd's murderer got bail, Madoff got bail, Harvey Weinstein got bail. Now, she totally believes, Frank, it's a very good question, that she cannot get a fair trial because after these months and months and months of terrible publicity, calling her a monster and calling her everything, and documentaries, which, of course, nobody talked to. The family is breaking the silence with us on the CBS Paramount Plus series, but they have not spoken before beside her one brother, Ian, who is like the spokesperson of the family. So after months and months and months of one-sided publicity, how can you, Frank, find one juror who has not heard about Ghislaine Maxwell?
That's right.
And heard about her being described as a monster.
Now, we have seen photographs of her with world leaders like Bill Clinton. She was friendly with royalty like Prince Andrew. You quote her in this Daily Mail piece, though, as saying she objects to the term socialite. Why does she have a problem with that description of her, of the term socialite?
Socialite? What is socialite, Frank? I mean, you yourself are very social. We enjoyed you so much over breakfast, right?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't mind being described as a socialite. No, however, no one seems wanting to describe me as a socialite, though.
I know. We have to tell them, right? Because you're very social. But
right.
So are Bill and I. And by the way, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, many of the people who are mentioned as her friends are my friends as well, and I am hosting dinners and lunches for people. Tomorrow, Bill and I are hosting a dinner for Sarah Sanders. Nobody would say that I'm a socialite. I'm very hardworking, and being social is part of our life, right? And we enjoy it. What I think they're trying to describe her in a very unflattering way, that oh, she's not working. She was just a wealthy socialite because her father used to be rich, and then her boyfriend, Jeffrey, used to be rich, and the other boyfriend used to be rich. But Ghislaine was working from age of 15. She's a banker. She made her own money deals. And yes, she's very social. I can tell you that you see with my piece at the Daily Mail that even in the worst conditions, being detained for more than 500 days, she didn't lose her sense of humor. So you can just imagine that she was a ball of every party way before this horrific situation. And again, don't misunderstand me, Frank. If she did what she's being accused of, she should be punished and she should be rot. She should rot in jail because it's terrible to manipulate young girls and ruin their life. But you and I do not know that. I mean, if we knew that, why would we go through such a costly trial? Let's not forget our constitution. She is innocent until proven guilty. And if she's guilty, she should pay the price. But do we know that? We don't.
Well, you're exactly right. And I think that's if this kind of treatment is absolutely unconscionable in the United States. Now, does she think that she is being scapegoated because they don't have Jeffrey Epstein to convict because of this situation?
She absolutely thinks so. You nailed it, Frank. And as a proof is that until Jeffrey killed himself or was killed, and there are many theories about it, she was not charged with anything. And her attorneys talked to the authorities at all time, and they said, whenever you want her, she is willing to come and give you the facts that you want or answer questions. She was not asked to come when there was nothing against her. Even after he killed himself, when her head of security, Matt, begged her to leave the country, she refused because there was nothing against her. Her lawyers were communicating with the authorities until almost a year later, she was arrested in this big hoo-ha-ha, you know, with the helicopters and everything. No, she definitely thinks that she is like the scapegoat for Jeffrey running away. And you know what? Look even at the charges. She's not Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein was a horrific pedophile who ruined so many lives. And let's see whether she was a complicit or not. We'll find out at the end of the trial. But Epstein, she's not.
Finally, Daphne, you alluded to the documentary series you're doing for Paramount Plus on this case. When can people look forward to seeing that?
The series will be 4 hours on CBS Paramount Plus and ITV in the UK. It will be in February after the trial is over. However, tomorrow, Frank, they would start being, you'll start seeing clips on CBS in the morning, then Entertainment Tonight and Extra from the interviews with their siblings for the first time. As I said, we decide the series will be at the end because we don't know. There may be a happy ending for Ghislaine, or there may be a happy ending for the victims.
All right.
We don't know.
Absolutely. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. Daphne, I realize you are a hot commodity right now. I appreciate you making some time for us this morning.
And Bill says again, www.og2d.com. You can find the latest update about Ghislaine's trial.
Well, we will look forward to that. Daphne Barak, you can read the article in the Daily Mail on my Facebook page, facebook.com/MoranoFan. You could check out that NFT for periodic updates. If you want to comment on any portion of my discussion with Daphne, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
Wherever you go, go, go with 77 WABC. Go, go!
We are New York on New York's Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano with you until 5 o'clock this morning. And then Juliette Huddy and I will bring you the early news from 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. Looking forward to that. And I'll tell you, one of the things that I've noticed with daylight saving time is now when I drive home after 6 o'clock, it's no longer dark. So I leave here 6:15, 6:30, and I drive home, and it's either already sunny out or it's sunny by the time that I get home. Now, I know a lot of people like that they leave work and it's sunny and they find that they're not less depressed. One of the things that I've found is while the fact that it's bright out and it's sunny out does help you stay awake while you're driving home, being in the sun for a 45-minute to hour drive home, it makes it a little more difficult to get right to sleep because it feels like the middle of the day. Whereas before, when it was dark still, you felt a little as if, okay, it's still kind of bedtime. But going to bed when it's bright and sunny out, I don't know, feels a little counterintuitive. I mean, I'm still able to get to sleep. Some days it's just a little more challenging than others. Hey, you know what really is challenging? It's trying to lose weight. You count calories, you watch what you eat, you exercise, and so often, at least in my case, it seems like I have a difficult time not losing weight and keeping the weight off. So Mitch Suss, the founder of the Skinny Center, which has done wonders with my colleague Greg Kelly, he reached out to me after I was complaining about seeing myself on video and thinking that I looked like Dom DeLuise. And he said, look what we've done for Greg Kelly. We can do the same thing for you. So I'm going to get this lab work done at the Skinny Center in Westchester County. This lab work pinpoints why you can't lose weight. But to jumpstart it, Mitch has sent me this sublingual spray called Skinny Spritz. So I just got it today. I'm going to start using this. I've used other similar sublingual sprays before and have had a lot of success with them. And it seems like a great way to control your appetite so that you don't end up overeating even when you're keeping these
odd hours. I was skeptical about this, and I'm pretty optimistic at this point. My skepticism has been replaced by optimism. So if you want to join this journey that Greg Kelly has been on, that I'm looking forward to embarking on, then you reach out to the Skinny Center, 914-703-4811. That's 914-703-4811. Or go to theskinnycenter.com. That's theskinnycenter.com. Maybe I'll see you down there. Straight to the phones we go. Six open lines if you want to jump on board. 800-848-WABC. Rosemary is in the Hudson Valley. Hello, Rosemary.
Hi, I was going to talk about the New Yorker piece, but I shelved that about this Maxwell case. Nobody should be treated, we know that, inhumanely. But the stuff that she wasn't a part of it, I'm not a documentarian, but I read so many things in the paper, and she was always draped over Jeffrey Epstein. She know what she did. She know what he did. She know what he was, and she was a co-conspirator. That's my opinion. And I do hope she does get a fair trial, but it doesn't look good.
We'll see what happens. We will see what happens. I may have to make – I try to keep the events that I go to during the day somewhat limited, but I may have to make an appearance at this trial because it's looking like it's pretty interesting. And I do miss covering these criminal trials. That is something that we have missed a great deal during COVID. So I'm going to try – I may try and get there. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Coming up next hour, we got the $1,000 minute, and I'll give you an opportunity to win some money. Let me say hello to Carol in New Jersey. Hello, Carol.
Oh, hi there, Grant. Two excellent interviews tonight. Stephen Kinzer and Daphne Block. I thought they were fantastic. You know, I think they're going after Maxwell because they can't go after Epstein. But she is complicit, though. That is true.
Well, you can bet that if that's the case, she will be convicted. At least that's my hunch. It's very important people don't prejudge. And a lot of times I've covered a lot of trials and the depiction in the press was light years from reality. So we'll see what happens. I tend to think you're right, though, Carol. We'll see what happens. I say if she's guilty, throw the book at her. 100%. All right. Until next hour, your influence counts. So use it.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Do you want to be like Portugal? Well, I mean, there's a lot of things to like and or dislike about Portugal. I'm sure in this case, I want to tell you about a trend in the workplace. I brought it to your attention on the WABC Early News Thursday or Friday of last week. And I'm curious if you think this is something that we should adopt here in the United States. Portugal might very well be on its way to becoming the premier destination on Earth for work-life balance. In November, lawmakers in Portugal passed new labor laws meant to protect people from working overtime and during their off hours, including one law that bans managers from texting employees in their personal time. According to the AP, the new law came in response to the growing population of people who work from home following the COVID pandemic. As part of this legislation, companies that have more than 10 workers could face fines for disturbing their employees during their downtime unless it's under exceptional circumstances and will now have to compensate their staff
for any work-related expenses they incur at home. The only measure that didn't pass was one that would have granted workers the right to turn off any work-related communication systems while online. Quote, remote working has great advantages provided we control the disadvantages. That's Anne Mendes Godino, Portugal's labor minister. The pandemic accelerated the need to regulate what already needed to be regulated. Well, I think this is really interesting. For starters, the one law which I don't think anybody can question is them not allowing workplaces to force employees to incur work-related expenses. Okay, if you incur a work-related expense at home, of course your company should pay for that. To me, that shouldn't even be a debate. Whether that means a computer, whether that means a mobile phone, whether that means something else, of course your employer should pay for any work-related expenses you incur while at home. 100%. No debate about that. Now, the more controversial aspect of this, and one that I'm curious to see if it gains traction around the rest of the world and in this country, is the part of the legislation that prohibits employers from contacting their employees during their downtime, the weekend, for instance, the evening. Is that something that you'd like to see adopted in the United States? 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Should it be illegal for your workplace to bother you after hours? That's the question.
A question. Since before your sun burned hot in space and before your race was born, I have awaited a question.
I am a poor example of this because I've always been asked for the last 17, 18 years or so, oh, how many hours a day do you work? How many hours a week do you work? My answer is I have no idea. I have no idea how long I'm supposed to be working or not, because I am literally working all the time, all the time. If I am watching a movie, I am watching a movie so I could talk about it on the radio. If I'm reading a book, I'm reading a book so that I can interview an author about it. If I am going out to a restaurant or spending time with friends, I am doing those things not only because they're fun, but I'm doing those things in the hopes of getting material to talk about on the radio. My whole life exists to be a radio show. And to the extent that I have an interaction with someone that's purely social, which does happen from time to time, that relationship building that I'm engaging in on a daily basis, that's all designed to promote this radio show or to get more content for this radio show or to get more guests for this radio show, or in some ways to promote this radio show. Now, I love to work, given the work that I do. So what I do for fun is work. On the weekend, I will start my day by going through all my work-related email. But the thing is with me, I really don't know where my work life begins and my personal life begins. My work life ends and my personal life begins because all of the newsletters that I subscribe to in the hopes of being able to put in a well-informed show on a daily basis, those are all newsletters that I would subscribe to anyway, just because I'm interested in them. All the research that I do about the MK Ultra program or aliens or crop circles, whatever the case may be, Loch Ness Monster, that's all research that I would be doing anyway. So, and because I have odd hours for me are 10 a.m., 11 a.m., noon. And in terms of my interactions with everybody else, both the people that work on this show and the people that work at the station in general, I email them and text them at all hours of the day, 7 days a week. Now, for instance, the other day, the podcast wasn't loading properly. I think it was a technical problem. I emailed and texted every single person that I could find that was even remotely involved in the podcasting process. So if I lived in Portugal, then I don't think I would be able to do that. I wouldn't be able to bother Matt and Molly and Christian and Doug and Matt and Matt and all the 500 people that we have here that are named Matt. So I can't relate to this. However, if you're an accountant, if you're an attorney, if you're a teacher, if you work at a museum, I can understand after putting in 7-8 hours at work on your feet some of the day and, you know, working hard, that maybe come 5 p.m., you don't want to be bothered by your boss. I get it. I get it. And I've always been sympathetic for that reason to the argument for children of limiting homework. I think it's terrible when these children come home from school and do 2, 3, 4 hours worth of homework. Now, I had that when I was in school, and I had a very novel solution. I just didn't do my homework. And I would go up to my room, pretend I would do was doing my homework, and instead I would take a nap. And I can guarantee you the nap was probably the more productive use of my time, 9 out of 10 times. But if you're a worker, whether you're working from home, part of the time, full time, would you like to see this law passed in the United States? 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Should your employer be prohibited from bothering you on the weekends and after work hours? 800-848-9222. Mike is on Staten Island. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Frank. Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Mike.
I believe communication is the key to modern civilization. Without it, we'd fall apart. Some jobs you need to speak to your next one who's after you, the one who came before you, for safety protocols, for some, like for me, I fix elevators. If I don't speak to the guy who was there before me, I don't know what I'm going into. I think this is absolutely nuts. They want to, communication is so terrible between people right now as is, and they want to limit it to even less. I think it's crazy.
Mike, I tend to agree with you, right? But what do you say to those who might take the other, just to play devil's advocate here, people might say, look, I work 8, 9, maybe even 10 hours a day. When I come home, I want to be able to decompress a little bit. I want to be able to spend time with my family, spend time working out, spend time watching a movie, just relaxing and not worrying about my boss blowing up my phone for a couple hours. What do you say to those argument to those arguments from people that say, well, look, I deserve a break?
Listen, you work, even if you work at 12-hour shift, you're off for 12 hours. You're off just as long as you're on. It takes 5 minutes. It could save somebody's life. I don't agree with those people. If they don't like their occupation that much, go find another one.
Hey, all right, Mike. I hear where you're coming from. 800-848-9222 if you disagree. The United States is the only country, the only Western country, that doesn't mandate paid vacation for its workers. So there is a problem with burnout in many different professions. And I think we need to do something about that. I'm not sure this is the solution for some of the reasons that Mike mentioned. But I do want to point out that there is a prohibition, excuse me, there is an exception for if there's an emergency. If there's an emergency, you can contact the person. That's the emergency exception. By the way, I want to correct something that I did earlier. I was talking about the, a gentleman who was taking LSD. I think I said his name was Ken Kesey. Ken Kesey's name is pronounced Ken Kesey. Ken Kesey. My error. I had read Ken Kesey's name before. I had never said it, or and I don't believe I'd heard it. So thank you. I appreciate that very much. That is from Tom. 800-848-WABC. Chris is in Bethpage. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Frank, love your show. Okay. You know, I like to contribute on your Facebook page, too. It's great.
Thank you.
All right. Just a couple things. You know, you're going to go on Beat Bernie. And I love the show. I listen to it all the time. And like you, most of the time when I'm sitting at home, I go 4 for 5, sometimes 5 for 5. And I can't believe that the, you know, that people couldn't get it right. So I went on it. I was a contestant on Beat Bernie about 3 months ago. So the first question was about Duck Dynasty. And I watched the show all the time. I used to watch it, blah, blah, blah. But I had a total blank on it. I couldn't come up with Duck Dynasty. You know that, you know the Duck Dynasty show, right?
Yeah, but I've never seen it. So if there's a question about Duck Dynasty, then I'm in trouble.
I know. See, that's the problem, too. It's like, what are they going to ask? And, you know, that's, it's also, I have a slight problem with the contest, too, in that it's totally geared to just stuff Bernie knows. You know, that's it. It's like, God forbid you ask them, like, you know, a question like, what was Tom Seaver's number? You know,
right,
I mean? Like,
right, right, right,
no
right,
idea.
41,
so,
yeah.
So, right, you, of course, you know that. But anyhow, my only advice to you is obviously be up on your presidential trivia.
Well, the presidential stuff I'm not worried about. That's my sweet spot.
Right. What was the question you missed last time with him?
It was about the USS Missouri. Where they signed the armistice to end World War II. I got one other question wrong, too, but the one that I should have known was the USS Missouri, that they call Old Miss.
Right. Okay. All right. That's it. Good luck to you. And listen, can I just a slight criticism, and I don't want them to take it the wrong way, but I listened to the updates by Matt Sapiens at the top of the hour.
Mm.
And he gives, I don't know, does he give you teases or does he want to give you the news? Because he said, and the Yankees are throwing a lifeline out to a former manager. I didn't know what he meant by that.
Yeah, Matt, you want to address this? Why should I be the only one that's criticized here? Address this, Matt.
Well, the Yankees are apparently picking up a manager that the Mets recently tossed out.
So who is the manager?
The manager's name, let me pull it up from the article that I got it from. Just give me one moment.
Yeah,
here.
But I kind of get what he means, is that either you're going to tell us or you're not going to tell us.
Right.
Why tell us?
Right.
Why? It's like saying, hey, someone might be running for office soon, whereas, like, I will tell you Andrew Cuomo is considering running for attorney general. I get what Chris means there. You're not really telling us. Oh, so now I see it's Luis Rojas. They may bring in Luis Rojas as the third base coach. Well, as a Met fan and Yankee hater, all I can say is God bless them. If they want to hire Luis Rojas, may they be as lucky as we were. Hey, Chris, thanks for the call. Oh, go ahead. What are you going to say?
Frank. Oh, hey, Frank.
Yeah.
Oh, no, one more thing. And also ask him, what's the charge they dropped in the Kyle Rittenhouse case?
It's the gun charge. The gun charge.
I know, but he didn't say gun charge. That's what I'm saying.
All right, yeah. No, you got to keep him honest. You got to keep him honest. He's slippery. He tries to. He's got his own agenda with these news reports. But, yeah, that gun charge being dropped in the Rittenhouse case is pretty significant. I get what he means. You get what he means, right, Matt? No, you're doing a great job. I'm just teasing. But you do want to tell people what the news is, not necessarily give them a hint as to what the news might be.
Roger
you
that.
You get what he means? Yeah, mm-hmm. I get what he means. 800-848-WABC. Joan is in Connecticut. Hello, Joan.
Yes, hi. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
I congratulations. I hear you're expecting a child.
This is true, yes. My wife is doing the hard part of it. My part was relatively painless.
Well, I just wanted to speak to the time with the family, time at home. And as you come into parenthood and when you have responsibilities in this day and age, especially as you see what's playing out in Virginia, this was my battle with the schools over my children and who owned them and who had the right to decide their future. Eventually we took them out and homeschooled them. Very few homeschoolers on Long Island in New York, but that's what we did. And we understand the fight, and you might need time for that kind of thing. And also for bringing up your children yourself, if we decide to abdicate to the government on this issue, especially, we are headed towards a brave new world.
No, I hear that, Joan. So where does that leave you with respect to this Portugal law?
You need your time at home. You need your time at home. This is in regards to the time at home.
So
you need your time at home to be at home with your family to address all of these things.
So it sounds like you'd be supportive of this Portugal law.
Is it a Portugal law? I only heard that it was the law that would stop your employers from bothering you at
right.
home.
Right. That's yes. exactly right. That's now the yeah. law in Portugal. It sounds like you think that okay. that would make sense here.
Yes.
Okay.
I think it would make sense. Because the greatest responsibility you're going to have in your life is taking care of that newborn and that child and that adolescent and sometimes that adult.
This is true.
You're going to need time. You're going to need time for that. I love it that your wife is an in-charge lady and can handle a lot, and that's wonderful, but she needs support too, and she needs time away.
Well, thank you.
And all of that is important.
Thank you, Joan. So that's one vote for the Portugal law, one vote against so far. The Portugal law, if you're just tuning in, would prevent your employer from texting you or emailing you or calling you during off hours. Can't bother, unless it's an emergency. Can't bother you on the weekend, can't bother you at night. Only during work hours. Unless it's an emergency. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. What do you think? Let's say hello to Dara in Saratoga. Hello, Dara.
Good morning, Frank.
Morning.
I've been a remote worker for years now, even before it was cool. And I have to tell you, I would be in favor of this law with provisions. With the company I'm working for right now, if I have to work off hours on an emergency basis only, I have it in my contract, I get premium pay from the time I turn on my devices, right? Because the companies that I used to work for, and this is before remote was really a refined role in the United States, used to take horrible advantage, and I would have no work-life balance. Give it to Dara because she's got the equipment right there.
Sure.
Give it to Dara because she's there and she doesn't have to commute in. And certain companies can take advantage, and then you end up working and have no life. Now how I have it is I literally have a room, an office, where that equipment is off and I don't go near it, and I have other devices for my personal work. There's one person at my job that has the liberty to get a hold of me on my personal hours, and that person has to authorize my premium pay before that kicks in. So I see young remote workers who are eager to get ahead kind of living in their office, and their office is their living, and that can be very unhealthy.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. So for the reasons you stated, it sounds like maybe you'd be in favor of this Portugal law as well.
Well, I don't like overreach in
right.
the private company. I don't like that, but I think everyone that's going to take a remote position or a position where remote working is possible needs to have that built into their work schedules and their work contracts, because it can get out of hand. And especially with mobile devices, if you have the type of job where it can be done over a mobile device, that goes everywhere with you. And there was a case, if I'm not mistaken, about a year or two ago, where the establishment of opening a work email constituted work. In the United States, these laws are very slowly evolving, very slowly evolving.
Good points, Dara. Good points.
Yeah, and I just think it's work balance is so important.
I agree. I agree. Most, not for me, but for most people. And my mother was, she retired after 29 years as a manager with a company. And she had a role where she was, this pre-pandemic, she was working from home 2 or 3 days a week. And the company wanted her to work from home. And because they had shared workspaces and whatever. Sometimes the companies make money. They save money, rather, with you working from home. So the company wanted her to work from home. And so what I would find is that when I would go visit her, she would be working all the time, even long after her workday had ended. And I'd go there on the weekend. She'd be working. And this is a company that I feel, I mean, they treated her okay. I never really felt like they appreciated her and everything that she did. So I would say, Mom, why are you working? Why are you working right now? It's Saturday. It's Sunday. And she would always say to me, what am I going to do? And I thought that was a shame that she didn't have more non-work-related hobbies that that added to that work-life balance. Now with the Board of Elections, where you can't really work from home, so she's, I think, in a better position. And hopefully she'll be in a position to do some grandparenting soon, where she'll be able to do that instead of working all the time. 800-848-WABC. Joe is in Branchville, New Jersey. Hello, Joe.
Hey, Frank. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks.
I kind of agree with the Portugal law, and I think that if your company would say, okay, listen, we may call you here and there, but you get paid for it, so that they don't call you for the stupid stuff because they obviously have a budget to take care of. But, hey, listen, if I call you, you know, you get $75 every time I call you or whatever it is, and they'll call you less and pick and choose what they really need to call you about.
Well, I think that's a fine idea. I mean, I think that's sort of the intent of what they're doing here, which is they don't want people to be laboring beyond the hours that they're getting paid for. And, you know, look, I think that's the intent behind this. I just wonder, to Dara's point, thanks for the call, Joe, is this a little bit of overreach? I am totally sympathetic with the goal here, which is you want people to not work 24 hours a day. When they're home and they were being with their family or just need some time to chill out, they should be able to enjoy a few hours of rest. That being said, should this really get to the point where employers are prohibited? I don't think so. I don't think so. The reality is, not just the media business, but so many companies these days are 24 hours. And if the boss gets a good idea about something, or if not even the boss, maybe some middle manager gets a good idea about something, should he really be prohibited from emailing it to his team? I don't think so. I don't think so. So I don't like this Portugal law for the United States. And not that everything that comes out of the government is bad, but the current government in Portugal is a socialist government. So I do wonder if this was not a socialist government, if they would be passing any laws like this. 800-848-WABC. Jim calling from upstate New York. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Frank. Love the show.
Thanks.
Yeah, I totally disagree with this. This is, you hit it on the head, socialist, safe spaces. This country was built on hard work and hustle. You know what I mean? That's what's going wrong with this country right now. That's why China's eating our lunch. You think China has safe spaces? I don't think we should go in the direction of China. It's just that you need to get a hold of me at 2 o'clock in the morning for something important. Get a hold of me. I'm a guy who can get a hold of 24/7. If someone's overreaching that, put them in their place. That's all.
You know, fair enough. And I have dealt with people who've complained about me contacting them during off hours in the radio business. And my attitude has sort of been the same. Like, okay, I mean, this is the life we chose. You know, you're in a competitive field for a reason. Ed the milkman, do you get upset when people call you and bother you with milk related business when you're not working?
I'm like you, it seems I'm always working in some sort of way, but no, you know, that's part of the deal, part of the business. You know, if you want to be successful, be accessible. People, and so I think, you know, it's just more regulation. How much regulation going to put on people? What are they going to do now? Tell you what color shoes you have to wear every day? It's just out of control, all the rules and regulations.
Well, I mean, there is a difference, Ed, right, between telling someone what color shoes they're going to wear and prohibiting their manager or their employer from taking advantage of them when they're supposed to be off. You could see the difference there, even if you don't agree with it, right?
No, I do, but I don't think that if somebody calls me and I'm on the phone with them for 2 or 3 minutes and it's going to make tomorrow a little easier or just make, you know, the whole workday go a little better because I got some information on something that's going to happen or might happen. What's wrong with that? You know, it's my choice if I want to answer the phone or not.
Well, that's fair. That's fair. I guess the proponents of this law will say if you choose not to answer the phone and someone else does answer the phone, then you're at you're at a little bit of a competitive disadvantage, which I get. All right. We're going to do the $1,000 minute coming up in just a minute. If you would like to try and win $1,000, then be the seventh caller to 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. If you're the seventh caller, you'll have an opportunity to answer 10 questions in 60 seconds. If you can answer the 10 questions, then you will be $1,000 richer. If you get one wrong or it takes you longer than 60 seconds, then you will not be able to answer the question. 800-848-9222. Excuse me, you will not be able to win. Matt was doing those things where he likes to talk to me in my headphones while I'm talking, which is quite distracting. But if you're not in a position to win on a game show, then you can at least take care of your retirement. And you can do it with gold, silver, and precious metal. Legacy Precious Metals is a company that is dedicated to helping you fight inflation. You remember those Gerald Ford buttons, win, whip inflation now? This is a great strategy to help you win, help you whip inflation now, because gold goes up as inflation goes up. The less the dollar is worth, the more gold is worth, the more silver is worth. That's why you really want to think about adding some gold to your portfolio. And if you have an existing retirement account, you might want to think about rolling it into a gold or a silver IRA. And you should do so with Legacy Precious Metals. The last time that the stock market collapsed and Americans lost their retirement, those that were invested in gold saw big gains and avoided the financial carnage. So if we're heading towards another stock market crash, then why not at least add some gold to your portfolio? Make sure you're hedging your bets. Gold should be a part of your investment portfolio. It's a part of mine. Legacy is the company that you can trust because they give you unbiased counsel based on your individual situation. Call 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. Or visit legacypminvestments.com. That's legacypminvestments.com. By the way, when they ask you on the website, because there's an option for finding more information, when they ask you on the website how you heard about it, be sure you tell them you heard about it from Frank Moreno.
Wherever you go, go, go with 77 WABC. Go, go!
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Now what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I'd like to say hello. Up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, and the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta bang, bang, the boogie to the boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the bang, bang, boogie, let's rock. You don't stop, rock the rhythm that'll make your body rock. Well, so far you've heard my voice, but I brought two friends along. And next on the mic is my man Hank. Come on, Hank, sing that song.
Check it out, I'm the C-A-S-N, the O-V-A, and the rest is F-L-Y.
Ah, yes, the great Sugar Hill Gang. A terrific, terrific contribution to the world of music. I actually met these guys. These guys, along with Biz Markie, performed at one of my friend John Tobacco's parties one year, and they were really great guys. They had some great stories, as well as certainly being terrific performers. All right, well, it is time for one lucky listener to have an opportunity to win some money, because it's time for
The Other Side of Midnight presents,
it's the $1,000 minute. Answer 10 questions correctly in 1 minute, and you could win $1,000. Here's your host, Frank Morano.
All right, let's meet this morning's contestant. We have
Zen calling from Toronto. Hello, Zen.
Hello, Frank. Thanks for taking my call, sir.
Now, Zen, what kind of a name is Zen? Is that short for something?
It's just sort of like a nickname, you know what
okay.
I mean?
Got it. All right. All right. Well, hopefully, hopefully the questions that we have don't have too much of a U.S. bias, and hopefully even as a Canadian, you'll be able to participate. Have you heard this contest before, Zen?
Yes. Yes. I'm south of Toronto.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes. Good. I got it. Yes. So if you answer a question correctly, I'm going to move on to the next question so that we can run through these questions quickly. If you don't answer the question correctly, then you'll hear a buzzer, and the timer will start as soon as I finish asking the first question. Got it?
Okay. If I'm thinking, there'll be dead air, so I don't have to, like, hum or anything.
No, you don't have to hum. Well, you don't have – obviously, you don't have that much time to think because you have to answer 10 questions in a minute.
Right on.
Okay. Ready to go?
Yes, sir.
All right. How many seconds are in a minute?
60.
What sport do the Los Angeles Dodgers play?
Baseball.
What radio show was on WABC immediately before this one?
The News.
The News. The News is on before this one?
Well, let me rephrase that. The News is really not a show. The News Report.
Yeah, I think that's incorrect. Dominic Carter's show is on right before this one, Zen. So he's on every day from midnight to 1. Does a great show. If you're not listening, I definitely recommend you check it out. But Matt, if you would, grab Zen's information. We'll send him a complimentary The Other Side of Midnight baseball cap. And if you're not lucky enough, as Zen was, to lose this contest, you could still purchase your own purchase The Other Side of Midnight baseball cap by going to WABCRadioStore.com. There's a ton of other great stuff on there as well. A merchandise from Rudy Giuliani, Bernie and Sid. Cousin Brucey always sells the most. So I'm trying to get some more Murano sales on there so that we can give Cousin Brucey a run for his money. So check out the website, WABCRadioStore.com. That's WABCRadioStore.com. And you can purchase The Other Side of Midnight baseball cap, as well as merchandise from all the other great shows as well. There's some other great merchandise from our show that they're going to be adding soon. So we're looking forward to that. All right. 800-848-9222 if you want to comment on anything we've covered this morning. In the meantime, I do want to bring you the 77 WABC clip of the day. Comes to us from the Bernie and Sid show. They're talking about the Biden administration and some of the struggles and challenges the Biden administration is facing.
Why is this administration continuing to lie to everybody to keep us feeling like a sick society? We know why. Ron and Sana did the same thing with you and I a couple of weeks ago. We pelted him with what's going on with the economy, and all he talked about was the pandemic. So as long as they keep the pandemic around, they've got a built-in excuse for anything. For anything. She mentioned pandemic 3 times right in that 30-second piece. What pandemic? It's over. It's over, dummy.
Exactly right. Look, cases are going to spike, but we have a vaccine. We have therapeutics. It is over. We have to live our lives. Stop.
Well, I agree that we have to live our lives, and I think we should live our lives normally. And the key to living our lives normally is getting the vaccine. That's why I'm very pro-vaccine. I think it is a little bit of an exaggeration to say that the pandemic is over. I mean, if you're we're seeing still somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 cases a day. We're seeing almost 1,000 deaths a day. So in 3 or 4 days right now, more people will die of COVID than died during the World Trade Center attacks. So I think he's oversimplifying a little bit, but
That happens in talk radio. I do agree completely with Bernie and Sid there that you absolutely need – we need to go back to living our lives normally and functioning normally and acting like everyday members of society. Now, one aspect of getting back to normal society is sports. And one of the things that I've been pretty excited about is this new Staten Island baseball team that our owner, our radio station's owner, John Catsimatidis, is a partner in. And I was already excited as a Staten Islander and a baseball fan and as somebody that works for this company. But when John hired my very dear friend of 20 years, Gary Perrone, to be the general manager of this baseball team, my enthusiasm went from, on a scale of 1 to 10, a 9 to an 11. I have been talking to Gary. The ideas that he is coming up with are things that nobody's ever seen in Major League Baseball, Independent League Baseball, Minor League Baseball. This is going to be incredible. Incredible. So anyway, on Wednesday, they're having sort of I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about this yet, but I will. They're having a party where they're going to make a big announcement about the team's future. And Wednesday at 5 p.m., I think it's going to be at the Kettle Black, and John is going to be here in the studio doing his radio show, the Cats at Night show, and he's going to be joined, I think, by Eric Schuffler, who's the president of the baseball team. I'm going to be in Staten Island at the Kettle Black with Gary Perrone, the general manager of the baseball team. We're going to be broadcasting from there, and we're going to have a lot of other high-profile people as well. And I believe that that is going to be where they finally announce the name of this new baseball team. And furthermore, I believe that they're going to make the announcement about this new baseball team by unveiling a new video introducing the new team to the world. And I was asked actually this week to narrate that video. So I think the first person to unveil the name of this new team will be me on Wednesday at 5 p.m. So I'm pretty excited about that. And I hope I didn't just jeopardize my opportunity to do this by talking about it, but it's going to be fun. Bottom line is you're going to want to make sure you're listening to this radio station Wednesday at 5 p.m. You'll hear John, you'll hear me, you'll hear Eric Schuffler, you'll hear Gary Perrone, and you'll hear some talk about baseball. And speaking of Staten Island, I want to thank the good folks over at City and State. They have put me on their list that came out yesterday of the 100 most prominent Staten Islanders or whatever, or the Staten Island power list. Apparently, I'm number 63. So I haven't looked at my write-up yet because it's been sort of a crazy day, moving couches and going to doctor's appointments and stuff. But I'm not sure where I was on this list last year. So I'm not sure if I'm moving up or moving down. I will tell you, though, my wife showed me the photo they used, and I don't love it. Again, I'm a little heavier now than I'd like to be, but I don't think I'm as heavy as I'm in this photo, because this photo was taken about 5 or 6 years ago, and you could tell it's an old photo because I don't have any gray hair in the photo. Whereas now, as Molly and Matt are so quick to tell you, I do have a very pronounced gray streak, almost Tulsi Gabbard-like or Don Pagano-like. Almost look like a skunk, like Pepe Le Pew. There's a giant gray streak. And I really... So it's an old photo. I don't love the photo they use, but if you want to read the Power 100 list, I'll link to it on my Facebook page. So just like the Facebook page at facebook.com/MoranoFan, and I will put up a link to it, because if they're nice enough to list me in it, I guess the least I can do is, is at least link to it on social media. So I'll do that right after the show, facebook.com/MoranoFan. I was very happy to see my friend Nicole Malliotakis as number one on this list. So good for her. Mike McMahon is number two. Vito Fisella, number three. So there's some good folks on this list. A lot of good folks who are friends of mine. All right. 800-848-WABC if you want to comment on anything we have been covering. And we're certainly welcome to do so on Twitter as well, at Frank Morano. That's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. Meantime, let me tell you a little bit about how you can improve your digestive health. What you want to do is try Life Change Tea. Life Change Tea is a phenomenal product that gives you a ton of energy without caffeine, and it is only available at getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. If you go to promo code, if you use the promo code Frank when you order, not only will the good folks over at getthetea.com know that you heard about it on this show, but you will actually be able to use enjoy free shipping. Getthetea.com, promo code Frank. Getthetea.com, promo code Frank. What is it? Not only does it give you a ton of energy without caffeine, but it's a gentle daily cleanse. It cleanses you from the inside out. All the junk that we're putting into our bodies because we're eating processed foods or eating preservatives or eating sugar or getting heavy metals in what we're eating. Or if you like me and you have booze a little too much, this is a great way to cleanse yourself, to get all the junk that's in your body on the outside. It's the tea that makes you go. If you're constipated, believe me, you won't be constipated anymore. And as I said, it'll give you a ton of energy without caffeine. Website, getthetea.com, promo code Frank. Promo code Frank means you save money on shipping. Getthetea.com, promo code Frank. It is the tea that makes you go.
Wherever you go, go with 77 WABC. Go, go! Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I am Frank Morano. You know, I got a message on Twitter from somebody who said that Andy B., who did that song there, also did a promotional song for somebody, another radio talk show host in Albany. And I must say, I felt a little cheated on that he's going to do show. He's going to do these things for everybody now. I thought this was something that was unique just to us. You know, and, you know, I finally, just during the commercial just now, I finally got around to reading the profile on me that they wrote in City and State as being the 63rd most powerful and prominent Staten Islander. Honored to be there. And I'm flattered that they included me. This is what they wrote, though. If you're not up all night listening to Frank Morano, you don't know what you're missing other than your sleep. Okay, that's nice. That's very nice. The inexhaustible radio personality does double duty, hosting The Other Side of Midnight from 1 to 5 a.m. on WABC, which he joined last summer, and co-hosting The Katz Roundtable on AM 970 with John Catsimatidis. Great. Both of which have topped their time slots. Great. And this is where I take issue. Now, I've done a lot in politics, and this is what they put. An astute observer of right-leaning politics, Morano has also served as chair of the Staten Island Reform Party. Now, I find that so limiting. Now, I mean, what about, first of all, I'm an astute observer of all politics, not just right-leaning politics, an astute observer of all sorts of political things. And, you know, I've been in the leadership of the Independence Party, the SAM Party. I didn't love that last sentence. But again, better to have a sentence about you that you don't like
than not to be included at all. Am I right? All right, we're going to do 15 seconds of fame in just a second. If you want to be heard on any subject for 15 seconds, now's the time. 1-800-848-9222. We don't screen the calls for content, so you can say whatever you like. The only thing we'd ask is you not use profanity and you not attack any of the other hosts. Other than that, say whatever you like. 800-848-WABC. You're certainly welcome to attack me, but 1-800-848-9222 now is your opportunity to be heard as part of
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
Let me begin with Neil on Staten Island. Hello, Neil.
Yeah, my sons went to the Jets game on Sunday. They charged $60, that's 60, for parking. Now I know what the F in NFL stands for.
800-848-9222. Tony is in Manhattan. Hello, Tony.
Hey, Frank. I heard you bash some guys last week that worked at the Trade Center saying that, you know, Rudy Giuliani lied about the air. I'm really shocked at you. Where were you when this happened? Picking zits, going to high school? Come on.
Thank you, Tony. 800-848-9222. Rogers in Massachusetts. Hello.
Yeah, I don't mind being contacted at work. It makes my life a little easier. I know what I'm getting into, but your couch, there's no removable legs or arms or anything?
Believe me, I checked, Roger. Believe me, I checked. No. We tried. I almost broke the legs trying to remove them. Raji in New York City.
A box on their businesses. Greedy price gouging supermarkets and some other businesses love inflation in that day. Then mercilessly jack up their prices by double, triple the inflation rates. Thank you.
Victor in Manhattan.
And because of COVID, surgeons are now doing virtual surgery. They send the patient a scalpel, sutures, and a detailed diagram of where to cut.
Eddie on Long Island.
America is still the land of opportunity. When a fake, phony, and fraud and criminal imbecile can become president of the United States. Go, Brandon.
800-848-WABC. Tyrone is in the Bronx.
Hey, whether it's a syringe or a penis, it's rape.
Thank you. 800-848-WABC. Allison is in Bayside.
My dream in life is to have Aunt Camille's egg salad.
That is a laudable goal. I'm hoping to get some today. Leo is in Manhattan.
Hi, Frank. I wish you good luck against Bernie. Try reverse psychology. Try to pass on somebody from his circles that you made bet $5,000 because last three times when he missed question, you have that one right.
Thank you. Alan in Newark.
Yeah, what's up, man? I listen to you guys all the time, man. My first time calling in, man. I want to say appreciate for all the news, updates, all the information, and you're leading us the right way, man. Thank you.
Thank you. 800-848-9222. Stan is in Connecticut.
Yeah, Frank Sinatra, Frankenstein, Frankenstein!
Thank you, Stan. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Antonio is here in New York. Hello, Antonio.
How you doing? I'd like to tell you that I believe that if the prices of things keep going up, we're all going to be in a depression. And I think if we end up in a depression, we'll probably never get out of it.
On that upbeat note, let me end with Billy in Brooklyn. Hello, Billy.
Sizzamoron, Sizzamoron, Sizzamoron.
I'm so pleased that we got that in. So pleased. All right. we'll be back tomorrow at 1 a.m. if you didn't get your 15 seconds today. Meantime, if you are wanting to be informed, stay tuned for the next hour because Juliette Huddy and I have got your number. We're going to tell you about all the news you're going to be talking about all day as part of the WABC Early News. Meantime, you want to stay in touch with me, you can email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com.